Good evening. We'll call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy and Finance Committee to order. The first order of business will be the Pledge of Allegiance. Will you please stand with me? I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you for being in attendance this evening. Just one small change in the agenda. We're not going to take any testimony. We're just going to go outside and drink some beer and enjoy the weather. Is there any objections? No, just kidding. First of all, first order of business here is I'm going to pass the microphone to your state representative, Representative Jim Neuberger. Can you hear it? Sure. Yep, we have an agenda, and what we're doing is right now we've got speakers who've requested to testify. We're going to be passing around a list for additional public testimony. I was kidding about drinking beer outside. Okay, there will be no more jokes for me for the rest of the evening. We've wrapped that portion of the agenda up, so my apologies. But at this point, I'd like to pass the microphone to your state representative, Representative Jim Neuberger, for some introductions.
Thank you, Chair Garofalo, and thank you, everyone, for being here. I am Jim Neuberger. I'm your state representative. And on behalf of the committee, I want to thank everyone here. A few special people I'd like to point out. We have our Mayor Lefty Kleiss. We have Mayor Tim Gunner. We have our County Commissioner John Riebel. They also represent the area as well. We also have Public Utilities Commissioner Betsy Wergen. Betsy, where are you? Betsy, come on down. You're the next contestant on The Price is Right. No. Thank you so much. And then I would be remiss if I didn't thank the members of our local BPOU. Some of those folks are here. God bless you. You're the salt of the earth. But finally, I have to reserve my best thanks to my wife, Michelle, who without her, I couldn't do any of this. Thank you. I love you.
Next, Mayor Kleiss, if we could get the microphone to him. You're right up front here. Mayor Kleiss is going to welcome us to the city and do a brief. Just grab that microphone. There you go. Thank you.
Okay, everybody hear me? Well, thank you, Pat and Jim. And this is a special event. Not every day we have the legislators come down and see us here. Usually we're heading down there, so this is nice. I thank you all for coming, and especially to you guys in the audience, thank you for participating in this huge, huge event. And other than that, as Pat said, the beer is outside. No, it's not. But don't forget, this is going to be probably a little bit on the warm side tonight. We do have some establishments in town, and feel free and stop by and see one or two before you head out. Thank you for coming once again.
Thank you, Mr. Bear. Next, if we could have our three committee pages come up to the table and introduce themselves. And just tell us your name, what school you go to. Make sure you say it in the microphone, the school you go to. And if you could be an animal, tell us what animal you would be and why. So please.
Good evening. My name is Grant Steffens. I go to Becker High School here. If I was an animal, I would probably be a peregrine falcon.
And why?
So you can dive over 200 miles an hour.
That's good answer. Plural. Good answer. Okay. Hi.
Hi. My name is Katrina Williams. I go to Spectrum High School in Elk River. If I could choose an animal to be, I would be a cat because they are lovable and they get to sleep a lot.
I'm Alex Stang, and I go to Becker High School. And if I had to pick an animal to be, I suppose I'd probably be a wolf because, well, they're pretty intelligent, and it's about the only thing a person has to be scared of when they're out hunting besides grizzlies. So, of course, not around here, obviously, but, yeah, I'd be a wolf, long story short.
Well, thank you to each of our pages for volunteering and serving tonight. We really do appreciate it. So what we're doing now is we're going to take the microphone and just pass it around. We have many legislators here, and we could we'll probably start on that side and just have legislators introduce themselves and what district they represent. And I know we have a couple of state senators here, so if they want to come up to the table and introduce themselves as well. But Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Eric Simonson. I represent House District 7B, which is the western half of Duluth, and happy to be here tonight. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. My name is Karen Clark. I'm a state representative from South Minneapolis. I represent three inner-city neighborhoods, and look forward to the evening.
Hi, my name is Melissa Hortman. I'm a state representative for part of Brooklyn Park and part of Coon Rapids.
I'm Representative Bob Gunther from Southern Minnesota, District 23A, and I'm from Fairmont.
Good evening. I'm Dan Fabian. I represent District 1A, which is, well, to put it in perspective, southern Manitoba and eastern North Dakota. So, thank you.
Hi, I'm State Representative Marion O'Neill, and I have just on the other side of the Mississippi River, which is Buffalo, Monticello, where we have a nuclear power plant as well, and Maple Lake and the townships that surround that.
Hello, I'm State Representative Peggy Scott. I represent the cities of Andover, Northern Coon Rapids, and one precinct in Ramsey, and that's 35B. Thank you for being here.
Good evening, everybody. My name is David Baker. I'm a state rep from Candiota County, also includes Wilmer, Spicer, New London. It's an honor to be here tonight, and I look forward to lots of good discussions.
You know me.
State Senator Dave Brown from Huron Becker.
Good evening. My name is Jim Knobloch, state representative from the St. Cloud area, including northwest Sherburn County. And I'm going to have to leave for a while, at least at 6:45, to speak to a Haven Township meeting at 7 o'clock. But thanks for all of you being here tonight.
Hello, I'm State Senator Mary Kiffmeyer, and I'm your next-door neighbor senator. But I also, before redistricting, did have Becker, and you're still a very important part, and your coal plant is very important. So I'm glad to be here tonight. Thank you.
Good evening. I'm State Representative Dennis Smith, representing Maple Grove and Osseo.
Hi, I'm Representative Chris Wozenski. I represent House District 16A, which is down in the southwest portion of the state. City of Marshall would be the largest city in my district.
Good evening. I'm Representative Bob Vogel from District 20A, which is southern Scott County and western Le Sueur County.
Sandra Erickson, state representative from the other side of this district, the A side of 15.
Good evening. I'm Nick Zerwas. I'm a state representative. I represent Big Lake Township, the city of Big Lake, Elk River, and a little bit of Otsego. Thank you so much for turning out such a large group this evening.
Hi, I'm State Representative Jean Wagenius, representing parts of South Minneapolis and Richfield, and thanks for inviting us.
Good evening. My name is Eric Lucero, the state representative from the Wright County area, District 30B, and I represent the cities of Albertville, St. Michael, Otsego, Hanover, and the Wright County portion of Dayton.
Representative Hertas is here as well, right? So, just want to, Representative Jerry, would you want to introduce yourself, Jerry? Or?
I can use my voice. I'm State Representative Jerry Hertas, representing 33A, which is the western one-third of Hennepin County, cities of Moisetta, Orono, and Atrista, 11 communities out there,
two main. Thank you very much. Okay, so the next item on our agenda is that we are going to be doing a remote presentation, a remote speech via Skype. Are you able to connect, Terry, or not? I heard that former Representative David Fitzsimmons is here. Former Representative David Fitzsimmons, and you're currently the, what's your position with Congressman Emmer's office?
I'm Chief of Staff for Congressman.
Well, it's great to see you again, David. All right, so it looks like we have the Skype conversation up. Are we able to full size it? And I'm going to walk over there.
Let's not do that again. So does it need to be the audio? Sound right out here?
hold the mic up.
Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, but the image is really bad, unfortunately. Yep. Well, if anything, we can just have audio. Go ahead. Begin your presentation, sir.
I just had three quick points on. First, global coal use is soaring. Second, the Clean Power Plan won't stop climate change. And then my final point, why the Clean Power Plan, or rather how the power plan repeats the policy mistakes of the past. First, we talk a lot about shale oil and shale gas here in the United States, and rightly so. It's been a boom for the American economy. But we neglect the fact that since 1973, the form of energy globally has grown quickly as the coal market. Can you hear me? Is this audio okay?
Yeah, I'm going to turn off the video and see if we can hear you better.
Okay.
Otherwise, we may not be able to do this. Where do I shut off the video? There we go. All right, try it now with just audio, and we'll see if we can hear you better.
Okay, sure. My first point is on the and how to the.
If we could have everyone turn off the wireless on your cell phones, we think it's probably flooding the connection. Because it tested earlier, fine, right? So if you want to give that a try and see if this works.
Put it on the airplane mode.
Or yeah, we don't have to put the phone on the airplane mode, but we can give that a try and see if it works otherwise.
Okay, if you can hear me, the audio will go forward.
Yes?
Yeah, just
Robert, he's going to call you on your cell phone.
Okay, all right. Oh.
Give it a try here and see if it works. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi, Mr. Chairman. I'm okay for me to go forward?
Yep, sounds good. Is everyone here? I'm okay?
Yep. Who is he?
Go ahead and introduce yourself before you begin.
Yes, hi. Thanks for having me. My name is Robert Bryce. I'm an author and journalist. I'm also a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and I specialize in energy issues, energy and power systems, and written 5 books on the energy business, and I'm going to speak specifically to the Clean Power Plan. I have 3 points, and I'll make them very quickly. First, global coal use is soaring. Second, the Clean Power Plan won't stop climate change. And finally, I'll explain how the Clean Power Plan simply repeats the policy mistakes of the past. So first, we're obsessed with shale oil and shale gas here in the United States, and rightly so. It's a very big deal. It's changed America's energy fortunes dramatically. But since 1973, no other form of energy has grown quicker than the coal business. Indeed, it's grown faster than oil, it's grown faster than natural gas, and why is it growing? Because the world wants electricity. No other energy form is as versatile or as powerful, and the countries that have electricity are the wealthy ones, and the countries that don't have electricity are poor. Now, to be clear, I'm adamantly pro-natural gas, I'm adamantly pro-nuclear, but as I said, the global energy story of today, and in fact the global energy story of the past four decades, has been the coal market. Let's look at the projections from the International Energy Agency, the Paris-based entity that is funded by the OECD member countries. Last December, the IEA reiterated its projection that by 2019 or 2020, global coal consumption will exceed global oil consumption on a par basis. In other words, when measured by BTUs or joules, global consumption of coal will exceed that of oil. Why is that important? Well, to put that in perspective, the last time coal consumption exceeded oil consumption in the United States was in 1949. Why is coal consumption booming? As I said, because of electricity demand. Countries all over the world are trying to provide more electricity to their people. And why is coal demand booming? Of course, to provide electricity, but further because that fuel is abundant. The deposits of coal are widely dispersed geographically. The prices are not affected by any OPEC-like entities. And finally, more than any other factor, it's cheap. So for a country like China, like India, like South Korea, like Pakistan, all of which, by the way, are building coal-fired power plants, they can't do what the United States has done over the past few years, which has been to replace a lot of coal-fired capacity with natural gas. They don't have the ability to produce the natural gas. They don't have the pipelines. They don't have the personnel that are able to do that. I recently completed a paper, it was published right about a year ago, for the Manhattan Institute. Between 1990 and 2010, roughly 1.7 billion people globally gained access to electricity. Of that number, nearly half, about 800 million of them, gained access due to coal. Now, the idea that, and I'll turn now back to the U.S., we talk about the war on coal, and I think there clearly is a regulatory assault on coal, but the idea that the coal is simply going to disappear in the United States is wrong. We are not going to replace it all with wind and solar. Let me give you some numbers. Last year, 2014, according to the BP Statistical Review, this is not my data, it's BP Statistical Review data, in 2014, coal use in the United States was 9.1 million barrels of oil equivalent per day. Now, I'm pro-solar. I have solar panels on the roof of my house in Austin, Texas. But all of the solar plants in the United States last year produced 84,000 barrels of oil equivalent. That means that coal use in the U.S. today, even despite the fact that coal consumption in the U.S. is down 20% over the last decade, coal use in the U.S. is still 100 times that of solar production in the United States. Now, let's look at China. Everyone knows China uses a lot of coal. Well, coal use in China today is roughly 39 million barrels of oil equivalent. That's fully half of global coal consumption. We hear over and over from the Green Left, Sierra Club, Greenpeace, oh, that China is moving toward clean energy, solar and wind, etc. It's simply not true. Last year, solar consumption in China was about 132,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day. Put short, China's coal use today is 300 times as great as its consumption of solar. Now, so what's the bottom line in terms of coal consumption and what will coal consumption be globally? Let's look at data from two outfits, the Sierra Club, adamantly anti-coal, and another group called Coal Swarm. According to their data, construction of coal-fired power plants today, that is, plants that are actively being built today, total over roughly 275 gigawatts. That's roughly equal to the entire installed coal-fired capacity of the United States. So the idea that the U.S. can save the climate by shutting down coal plants simply doesn't square. The fact is that coal continues to boom globally, and countries all over the world are building coal-fired power plants. China, India, Indonesia, Bangladesh, Vietnam, Thailand, Laos, Poland, Germany, Japan, all are building coal-fired power plants. My second point, the Clean Power Plan will not stop climate change, and the math here is straightforward. The EPA projects or wants the Clean Power Plan to cut CO2 emissions in the U.S. by roughly 800 million tons by 2030. That will be a drop in the global CO2 bucket. Over the last decade, between 2004 and 2014, global CO2 emissions rose by 5.2 billion tons. Thus, over the last decade alone, global CO2 emissions rose by six times the reductions the EPA is trying to achieve over the next 15 years. In China alone, CO2 emissions rose by 3.2 billion tons, four times the amount the EPA is trying to cut here in the United States. The hard reality, the truth is that the U.S. is already leading the world in reducing its CO2 emissions. Over the last decade, again since 2004, U.S. CO2 emissions have declined by 500 million tons. That's far more than any other country in the world. A lot of that is due to what I mentioned before, the decline in coal consumption, down 20% in the last decade alone, while the rise of natural gas has led to a 20% increase in natural gas consumption. But the 500 million ton decrease in the United States amounts to about six times the CO2 emissions reductions that have occurred in Germany, a country that has spent over $100 billion subsidizing renewables over the last decade and a half. And what can we see in Germany? What else can we learn in Germany? Rising electricity costs. Over the last 5 years alone, industrial electricity rates in Germany have risen by roughly 60%. German residential customers are now paying 38 cents per kilowatt hour. That's three times the residential rate of electricity in the United States. Okay, my final point. The Clean Power Plan repeats the policy mistakes of the past. And this is a policy that many in the audience, I'm sure, should remember. In 1978, Congress passed the Power Plant and Industrial Fuel Use Act. That restricted, effectively prohibited, the construction of new natural gas-fired power plants. Why? Because in the late 70s, the U.S. and Congress, Jimmy Carter, were convinced the U.S. was short of natural gas. Well, the problem wasn't a shortage of natural gas. It was too much government intervention in the natural gas markets. But nevertheless, in April of 1977, Jimmy Carter declared in a State of the Union or in a speech that the U.S. was in energy crisis and that we were running out of oil and gas. And here I'm quoting that too few, his words, Carter's words, too few domestic electric utilities have switched to coal, our most abundant energy source. Now, the irony here is obvious. The EPA is trying to shut down some of the very same power plants that fired by coal that were effectively mandated by the Power Plant and Industrial Fuel Use Act of 1978. Sherco is one of the plants that was built. Remember, Unit 3 at Sherco started construction in 1983, in large part as a reaction to the belief and the mandates by Congress that said we were running out of natural gas and therefore utilities should build more coal-fired power plants. This is we're now experiencing the EPA saying now they want to close some of the very same coal plants that were built in response to the 1978 Power Plant and Industrial Fuel Use Act. So I'll conclude with just a few obvious points. One is, I'm pro-natural gas, I'm pro-nuclear, but with the Clean Power Plan, the United States risks putting too many eggs in one natural gas basket. We need a diverse energy portfolio. We saw that during the polar vortex, where nuclear plants, coal plants were relied on. Natural gas in many parts of the country was running short because of super high demand. If we want to keep the lights on and keep prices low, and I emphasize keep prices low, then we should realize that coal should remain a part of the nation's energy mix, and particularly so because the U.S. is not the Saudi Arabia of coal. We're the entire OPEC of coal. America's coal deposits total some 900 billion barrels of oil equivalent. That's nearly as much as the 1 trillion barrels of proved reserves in OPEC. The reality is that we need to look at the Clean Power Plan in the global context with regard to CO2 emissions and energy mix. The U.S. is already reducing its CO2 emissions more than any other country in the world. In my view, the Clean Power Plan simply adds more complex regulation coming from Washington that attempts to supersede the power of the states. It won't stop climate change. Instead, it will further punish the coal sector and potentially make the U.S. too reliant on natural gas. I'll stop there, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to address them.
Thank you very much for your presentation. We'll take a couple. We have a couple of minutes here for questions from members of the committee, if there are any. Well, you must have did a good job, sir. No one in the committee has any questions. Thank you for calling in. Apologize for the technology issues, and thanks for your presentation.
You bet. Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Next on the agenda, we have Mr. Evans from Xcel Energy. We will certainly take questions as Mr. Evans is walking to the desk, but realize that we have testifiers who've signed up, and there should be, staff hasn't done it yet, if people wish to testify, we can pass out a testifier sheet to have additional testimony at the conclusion of those who have signed up in advance. So, Mr. Evans, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans, Director of Government Affairs for Xcel Energy. I want to thank you for the invitation, the opportunity to speak to you this evening here in your special session in Becker. Xcel Energy has and expects to continue to have a strong presence and commitment to this area, not only including the Sherco plant in Becker, but also our nuclear plant in Monticello and a significant presence in St. Cloud, which is part of our service territory. I've been asked to talk a little bit about the plant and about the Xcel Energy's presence in this area, and so I'm going to just go through a couple of facts. Xcel Energy employs more than 800 people in this area when you consider Becker, St. Cloud, and Monticello. In addition, we spend about $3 million annually with 40 different vendors who provide us with vending services at our plants that are from this area. Just in the Becker area, our employees have contributed almost $90,000 in the last year to local nonprofits, and in addition have contributed almost 1,500 hours in community service projects that our employees do. And that's just in the Becker area. I didn't get the information for St. Cloud and Monticello, but I am fairly certain that their commitment is to the community is just as great. And then, of course, as many of you know, Xcel Energy has paid more than $10 million in property tax last year for the Sherco plant, an additional $16 million in property tax for the Monticello plant. Xcel Energy is the largest property taxpayer in the state of Minnesota, and the bulk of that, of course, is at the place where our large plants are located. So needless to say, we consider ourselves to be an important part of the communities where these plants are and where our employees live and work. Of course, the committee is here tonight to hear about the Sherco plant primarily and about the Clean Power Plan, so let me tell you just a little bit. Some of you had an opportunity to tour the plant earlier today, and so this might be a little repetitive, but the Sherco Power Plant is one of the largest plants in the United States. Sherco Units 1 and 2 were constructed and became operational in 1976 and 1977, respectively. Sherco 3 was added in 1987, about 10 years later, and is 41% owned by the Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, the rest of it being owned by Xcel Energy. Together, the three units comprise the largest source of energy on our system, a total of almost 2,500 megawatts. Just for sake of comparison, Monticello is about 670 megawatts, and the two Prairie Island units together are about 1,100 megawatts. So this plant is significantly the largest plant that we have on our system. Questions about the operation of the plant and providing energy to our customers from that plant, as many of you know, are determined in a process in front of the Public Utilities Commission called a resource plan. We're required to file a resource plan every couple of years. And we're supposed to, in that resource plan, look out at a 15-year time horizon into the future and try to calculate how much energy we think our customers are going to need from us in that period of time and then try to also determine what would be the best way for us to provide the energy that those customers are going to need. That is a long process. We begin it by filing a resource plan, a proposed resource plan with the Public Utilities Commission, but then there is a long process which we are currently in the middle of. There will be a lot of discussions and a lot of deliberations, a lot of groups and people and organizations, businesses and what have you intervene and offer their own opinions about what would be the best way for us to provide the energy our customers are going to demand over that period. In this particular case, since filing the resource plan, which was done a little over a year ago, we have seen now the final rule coming from the EPA on the what's so-called Rule 111D to control carbon dioxide from existing power plants. And now the state of Minnesota, as members of the committee, I think, know, the state of Minnesota through the MPCA, and I know you're going to hear from David Thornton a little later this evening, they start to put together the state implementation plan. So as we're all trying to analyze the rule and figure out what the rule means and figure out what Minnesota's requirements are going to be, at the same time, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is in the process of trying to figure out how we're going to accomplish the goal that's required under the rule. In this process, which is an ongoing process, starting with our proposal, but then ongoing through the Public Utilities Commission, we are continually evaluating this proposal in light of the EPA's final rule, in light of the comments from other interested parties, further analysis of all the options that are there. It is a very complex financial and engineering analysis that involves potentially hundreds of millions of dollars of investment by the company and on behalf of our customers. It involves the cost of energy in the region. It involves the jobs of our employees and the impacts on our host communities. It involves the strength of the grid and the reliability of our system. All of these things are key components that go into the ongoing analysis of how we're going to provide the energy that our customers are going to demand in the next 15 years. Our reevaluation has not been finalized, but on October 1st, we will be filing additional comments on the plan. We look forward to, after those comments are filed, continuing with this process. We'll be presenting further proposals at that time, and there will be proposals that follow that. We're looking for potential solutions in that process, the resource planning process, and as I said, those comments will be filed, which is the next step, but not by any means the final step, on October 2nd. And after that filing, we will continue to work with the regulators as well as the elected policymakers as the process moves forward. Of course, we recognize the importance of these matters to the committee and to the members of the legislature, and we look forward to continuing our discussions with you as our resource plan and the clean power plan are considered through the process of the state of Minnesota. With that, I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. We have time for a couple of questions. If we can get a microphone to Representative Hortman. Just turn your microphone on, then, Melissa.
Okay, let's try it. Okay. Thank you for being here, and thank you for your testimony. I know in the past, Xcel has undergone changes in other parts of the system, and I would imagine that you have a process in place for when you make a decision to change the workforce at a particular location, that there's a certain timeline that you adhere to in terms of giving notice to employees and assisting them in either accessing dislocated worker benefits or retraining opportunities depending upon the particular worker. And I wonder if you could talk through some of the things that Xcel does in that regard, and then also just briefly touch on the planning that you do with the men and women of labor and the other utilities to deal with the very real workforce issues you have and the big demands for more workers in your field.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hortman, thank you for the question. I can't, not being in either HR or labor relations or energy supply, I can't give you a lot of detail on that. What I can tell you is that in the case of repowering the Riverside plant, repowering the Highbridge plant, and the gradual shutdown of the Black Dog plant, it has always been our goal to see that no one loses their job. And we have been successful in those three instances through transition and retirements and replacement of workers that they have not lost their job. Whatever ends up happening at the Sherco plant, in the next, you know, in the future, that will be our goal. I think I got the figure. Don't hold me to this, but I think something like 34% of our employees at the Sherco plant are currently of retirement age, and so we are looking at a turnover in employees at the plant, regardless. And of course, any time a plant needs to be shut down, another plant needs to be built, and that will obviously involve some additional jobs. Though typically, gas plants don't employ as many people as coal plants. And then I would add to that our nuclear plants continue, as the regulations continue to come out on nuclear plants, we continue to need more employees at our nuclear plants. So a combination of all of those factors, I think, you know, our goal will be that regardless of what happens at Sherco, no one will lose their job.
Any other questions for members of the committee? Representative Fabian. If you could pass the mic down to Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, and to Representative Hortman, I appreciate the work that might be done with displaced workers and so forth. But when I look around the auditorium here this evening, I see more than workers. I see members of a community. And I'm curious, heaven forbid that something were to happen at Sherco and it were to close. The impact isn't just on workers. I just got done eating at the Nick's Bar and Grill or whatever, and I talked to Shelley, the owner. She told me that if Sherco closes, she's closing. And they employ, you know, several people there. How do we go about protecting, and it's kind of a hypothetical question, I guess, but I don't really see anything that anybody does to protect a community who is reliant on, you talked about the property taxes just here on the Sherco plant of $10 million a year. That's going to impact the school. You know, I spent 35 years teaching and coaching. I understand that. It's going to affect nursing homes in the area. So what are the residual effects outside of the workers that communities are impacted with? For example, the Black Dog plant and the effect that that had on that community.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, again, I can't really, I don't have a lot of facts and figures on the Black Dog plant. I certainly, it seems to me that a plant that's as close to the metropolitan area as that plant, you probably see less of an impact just because there are more opportunities for people in that area. Certainly, there's no question that a large employer in a community like this, like the Sherco plant, you know, is a significant presence for our workers and for the community, and we are not unaware of that as we make our decisions going forward. The fact is, and you know, machines wear out, and you have to replace machines, and that's going to happen someday. And at that point, whether it's sooner or whether it's later, we're going to have to deal with what that means to this community and what that means to our workers at the plant. And all I can tell you on behalf of Xcel is that that is never far from our mind.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. We appreciate your testimony. So just for the next three testifiers that we have up, it's going to be Peter Nelson, Commissioner Thornton from the MPCA, and Mike Beard. And while Mr. Nelson comes up to the table, we had another legislator show up who will give her an opportunity to introduce herself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joyce Pepin. I'm the House Majority Leader. I represent House District 34A, which is just up the road a little bit in Rogers, where I live, and then Maple Grove and Dayton. It's an honor to be here and listen to learn more about the issues that affect your community, potentially more than many others in the state. So thank you for coming tonight, and it's an honor for me to be here.
Thanks. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Peter Nelson, and I'm the Director of Public Policy for Center of the American Experiment. We're a local public policy organization based in Golden Valley that focuses on promoting policies that develop a culture of prosperity in Minnesota. And to that end, we really believe that low electricity prices are central and a key factor to our prosperity moving forward. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about our electricity prices today in Minnesota, try to dig in a little bit more on what's going on here in the state, and then talk about how that's impacting jobs not only in Becker, Minnesota, but jobs across Minnesota, and tie that back in a little bit into the Clean Power Plan that we're talking about tonight. So I have distributed a pamphlet to all of you, and I am sorry for everyone in the audience. I did not bring enough. I did not expect this phenomenal turnout. But so some of you in the audience have some of these pamphlets as well. And there's four graphs in this pamphlet that talk about, that look at what's been going on with our energy prices, our electricity prices, across the three different sectors, the main sectors in our electricity that provide electricity to our businesses and our residences and our industrial manufacturers. And when you look at this, at these charts, there's one thing that stands out. Minnesota is, electricity prices are growing closer and closer to the national average. Historically, we have always been below the national average. And that goes back all the way to 1990. In fact, back in 1990, we had the ninth lowest electricity rates in the country. I believe in 2014, the most recent numbers, we're now at 25th, but we actually topped out at 28th in 2013. And when you look at this graph here, it's noticeable that we start growing closer and closer to the national average right around 2009, 2010. And I'll get back to that timing a little bit later, but that's important for our conversation with the Clean Power Plan. So we know that our electricity prices are growing, and they're growing faster than the rest of the nation right now. So why are electricity prices growing? They're growing for a lot of reasons. When you look at the rate plans, the rate filings where utilities ask to increase their rates, they cite a number of factors. The first factor, this started when the rate cases started coming around 2008, 2009, was the recession. The recession brought about basically lower demand for our electricity, and with lower demand, there's fewer customers, and with fewer customers, that meant there was fewer people to spread the cost of our electricity system around. So that meant everyone that was still paying had to pay a little bit more. And a second reason is power plant maintenance. We know that there's been some substantial maintenance to the Sherco power plant. There's been some substantial maintenance required for our nuclear power plants. And those ongoing maintenance costs have added up quite a bit. We've also had a lot of new transmission built out in this state. And I almost could have wrapped that into our green energy mandates, because a lot of the transmission costs that we've put forward has been tied into connecting all the windmills that we've been putting up around the state to the grid. And there's also some good pollution control measures that we've passed to reduce the mercury emissions from a lot of our plants, including the Sherco plant, and all of these, and then we've also got the green energy mandates. And I'm going to point out two in particular. The first is the renewable energy mandate, the requirement that utilities generate 25% of their electricity by 2025. Xcel has a little higher standard and a little tighter time frame. And the second one is the energy efficiency requirements that we have. Utilities are forced to spend a certain amount of money on energy efficiency programs, and they're required to meet certain goals for energy efficiency. And when I look at all of these different factors, I start looking at these factors and I ask myself, why are Minnesota's prices increasing faster than the country's? We all went through the same economic recession. In fact, Minnesota weathered that recession better than most states. So on that factor, Minnesota should actually do better. Every power plant around the country has maintenance issues. It's possible that we had more maintenance issues than other states, but everyone has to deal with that. And pollution control, that is actually one factor where I think Minnesota has led the country, especially on the mercury emissions. We have done a little bit more, so you can count that. But when you look at the list, what really separates Minnesota from the rest of the nation are the green energy mandates and the transmission lines that we've built out to connect so many of the windmills across the state. And so I want to talk a little bit more about the green energy mandates that we have in this state, and how and why there's possibly some higher electricity rates due to that. Because I do think that there's a link. We often hear that there isn't a link. We often hear that windmills aren't increasing energy costs. And I don't think that that's true. I think if it were true, if it were competitive, then we would see see it happen anyway. And I want to talk quickly about really just one issue. Well, two issues. First off, we're building out windmills when we don't need the generation. That means we're shutting certain things down ahead of time. And that means we've paid all these capital costs for plants like Sherco, and we can't recover those costs because now we have to build out windmills and use the windmills. The second thing is that the wind doesn't blow at the right time. It blows at night often, and often in the wrong season. And so when we sell wind into the grid, we actually get a very low price. We actually buy high and sell low in the wind system. I've done some research on a one windmill facility this past summer and found that on average, the windmill facility in southern Minnesota gets about 1.7 to 2.4 cents per kilowatt hour. And that's just not enough to pay back that windmill. And I know I've got to move on quickly here. So let me talk a little bit about jobs. It's not just the jobs here in Becker. When electricity prices rise, that has a serious impact on jobs across the state. If you're a teacher and the electricity costs rise just by one penny in the state of Minnesota, that adds $13.6 million to the bill, and that accounts for about 242 teacher salaries. And when the price rises by just one penny on manufacturers, that means 15,000 jobs. So we're talking about real jobs, real Minnesotans here, and from folks who are promoting a lot of these green energy policies, all we hear about are 15,000 targeted green energy jobs. But we have some targeted jobs in Becker, Minnesota, and we have some general jobs across the state that are impacted by these electricity rates. And when we think about the Clean Power Plan and that impact on Minnesota, we just have to look, I think, at our current energy policies, because in many respects, the Clean Power Plan really just adds on to what we're already doing, which I see a direct connection to higher electricity prices, fewer jobs, and less prosperity for the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Are there questions from members of the committee? Representative Horvin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, you talked about your speculation that green energy policies were increasing electricity prices. I was wondering if you were familiar with the fact that Minnesotans have saved $6.4 billion from energy efficiency measures in the last 25 years of the Conservation Improvement Program.
Mr. Nelson.
Representative Portman, committee, I am aware of that claim. However, I think that claim is quite dubious. It's when you look at these energy efficiency programs, you find that I think we're spending a lot of money on things that would have been done already. If our energy efficiency programs were actually succeeding, because we spend a lot more on energy efficiency than the rest of the country, we would see our energy usage per customer drop. Minnesota ranked 19th on residential customer usage, I think back in 1990. We ranked 19th again, and we've ranked 19th pretty much throughout that whole time frame. And there's recent research that has come out of the University of Chicago and I believe Stanford that has looked at some of our energy efficiency programs, weatherization programs, and they found that while they modeled it to save a lot of money, and we hear this all the time, we see it in Excel's and all the other utilities' reports on their energy efficiency programs, we see savings that they model, but when you actually look at it in practice, that program in practice actually lost 9.5% on their investment, and that actually included the societal costs, the societal benefits that they're talking about.
Representative Hartman, a follow-up, and then Representative Fabian.
Just a brief follow-up. Those are the utilities numbers and not the state's numbers and not an advocacy group's numbers. They come from the utilities themselves.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I don't know about the rest of you folks, but my energy bill has not gone down at home from my efficiency. I was in the hardware store in Roseville a few weeks last spring, and one of the local farmers who's a friend of mine stopped me and said, Dan, he said, I've been reading about this clean power plan and You know, not too many years ago on our farmstead, it cost us about $400 a month to run our farming operation. Now he said my bill is about $800 a month. So even with efficiencies and so forth, the prices are still going up. So I don't have a question. I'm just making a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Nelson. We appreciate it. Next up on the agenda, we have Commissioner Thornton from the MPCA. And my understanding is that we got an electronic copy of your presentation to put up on the board, on the projector. And then after that, it's Mr. Beard. And then after that will be the video message from Congressman Emmer.
And Mr. Chairman, the members should all have a paper copy of my presentation also.
Thank you. And welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the
record. My name is David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Air Policy at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you very much for inviting me to be here tonight. I'm going to walk you through what we understand about the final version of EPA's Clean Power Plan and highlight a few of the changes that EPA made since the proposed version that came out in June of 2014. I gave a presentation to the committee during session, and we talked about some of the concerns that we had in the EPA's proposal. And I'm happy to say that if you go to the next slide, EPA addressed most of the concerns that we've raised. And so our view of this final version of the rule is that it is improved from the proposed version. I have a separate slide for most of these points, except for the first one and the last one, so I'll talk about them right now, and then we'll go into the next stuff. The proposal did not include Sherco 3 in the formula for calculating states' targets, because Sherco 3 was offline for the entirety of 2012 because of an accident with a turbine. EPA, in the final version of the bill, has added, as we requested and suggested, a typical annual operating scenario for Sherco 3. It makes a huge difference in how our targets in Minnesota are calculated, and it makes our targets less onerous. So that was an important thing. We think that they have taken a good step towards recognizing early action that Minnesota has taken and other states have taken. We think our targets are more equitable compared to other states than they were originally. They have relaxed the interim compliance period to give more time and more flexibility. They have clarified how to allow for out-of-state renewable energy to count. They have clarified that they will allow for international hydropower to count, new international hydropower. They have created nationally consistent standards for fuel types, which was in the proposal. They did state-by-state standards, which we felt was legally an issue. And they also addressed environmental justice. They are asking each state to have some environmental justice outreach plan and to look at the impacts in disadvantaged communities. And so that's a positive. Next slide. They also proposed standards of performance for new power plants, new coal plants and new natural gas plants. And this would be anything built after January 8 of 2014 or modified or reconstructed after June 18 of 2014. I'm not going to get into this. If somebody wants to ask a question, we can go there. So what we're talking about, the Clean Power Plan, is the next slide. It's existing power plants. It's the next slide, please. It's existing power plants. As Mr. Evans mentioned earlier, this is the Cleaner Act Section 111D. It applies to existing fossil fuel plants. It establishes emission guidelines, and it makes states responsible for submitting plans. Okay, the next slide. So some of these slides, as you can see, we just rushed and put them in today. One of the things that we think that they've done a bit of improvement on is treatment of early action. It turns out that for states in this final plan, states that have taken actions prior to 2012 end up having less carbon-intensive targets than other states. So to the extent that a state has already taken actions to reduce its carbon footprint in the power sector, it's final targets are not as intensive. This is not the same as handing out coupons that you can trade in later, which is what some people have thought about when they think about credit for early action, but at least it does go in the direction of providing some credit. Then they've clarified that in between 2012 and 2021, anything that reduces annual emissions from the baseline counts, which is a clarification that that we were seeking. And they have set aside a special clean energy incentive program for the time period of 2020 through 2021, where you can get extra credit for low-income energy efficiency projects and certain kinds of renewable projects. So now a quick look at the compliance time frame, which is the next slide. The final rule came out this August. Initial state plans are required by September of 2016, in which point a state can ask for a two-year extension if needed to do things like rules. A progress report is due in 2017. The final plan is due in 2018. The Clean Energy Incentive Program kicks in 2020 and 2021, and then the first compliance period begins in 2022. The original rule, it was in 2020. And they've set three steps for compliance up through 2029, and then the final compliance target is 2030. They have relaxed the amount of reductions that would be required by the first compliance deadline, and they've provided states with some flexibility so that if our integrated resource plans that you heard mentioned earlier show a different progression of things that would be happening to comply with state energy policy, it would allow us to potentially fine-tune our compliance steps in those different years to comport better with what really is going on here in Minnesota. Then the next slide, real quickly. Rather than set each state's targets based on conditions within that state, they looked at three regions in the country: the Eastern Interconnect, which is that blue region, the Western Interconnect, the red region, and the Electricity Reliability Council of Texas, which is Texas. And they looked at the performance of coal plants and natural gas plants in those areas. They determined that the Eastern Interconnect had the least stringent performance, and those were the numbers that they applied nationally. So they've established a national standard for best system of emission reductions for coal plants and natural gas plants, and that's another reason why we believe that the target in Minnesota is less onerous than in the original plan. And so let's get to the mass targets, which is the next slide. When I talked to you before, I said our target was a lot more strict than all of our neighbors. And now you can see from this slide that they're all within the same range for the most part. EPA has set a rate-based target. You can choose to meet your target by meeting a certain emission rate, a pound of CO2 per megawatt hour, or you can also meet a ton of CO2 mass target. And as you can see, for all of the states around us, the rate targets and the mass targets are all within about the same ballpark. Notable changes here is North Dakota's target went from 11% reduction up to 45% reduction. That goes back to what I said earlier, in that the EPA has, in the way that they've recalculated the formula, essentially done some rewarding of states that have already taken action, and not so much for states that haven't done as much. So for the next slide, compliance plan, each state has to choose between whether you want to go down a rate path or a mass path. We have flexibility to meet the goals. Trading is encouraged. EPA will allow states to submit plans that make it possible for their utilities to trade within the state or to trade with utilities in other states in order to best meet their compliance targets. EPA has also provided a draft federal plan that would serve as a default if a state either refused or was unable to develop their own plan We now know what EPA's default plan would be. We call this a federal implementation plan. The acronym is FIP. Generally, states do not want to get FIPped by the federal government. But in this case, we can we at least know what it'll be. So our state
Commissioner,
planning...
Commissioner, we use acronyms sometimes. If you could just restate what FIP means.
FIP is federal...
I saw some heads behind you looking at each other like, what did he just say? What was...
Federal Implementation Plan.
Thank you.
It's what EPA imposes on a state if you don't do your own. And so in the next slide, another quick one that we put together. Here's our state planning process. Again, by September of 2016, an initial submittal is needed to EPA that outlines what are going to be the components of our plan. And we have to submit some assurances that we are on track to file a federal plan within another 2 years. In September of 2017, we have to follow up with an update to give them our progress, and then in September of 2018, the final plan is due. And the interim compliance date is 2022, and the final compliance date is 2030. So the last slide I have is what's next. We've already started requesting comments because we know that a rule change is going to be needed in order for our plan to be federally enforceable. We're going to be commenting on this draft federal plan, and we will continue our extensive stakeholder input and outreach process that we began over a year ago. We've had over 60 people participating in meetings over the last year. We are continuing with our next meeting on October the 8th. We've decided that we're going to send announcements for these meetings to all of the members of the committee, so you can participate if you like. They are offered both in person and by webinar, so you don't actually have to be there in person to participate in the meetings. And we're happy to add anybody here in the room tonight or anyone else that wants to be on our distribution list. We have some big decisions that we have to make, whether we want to go down the mass path or the rate path, what our state plan will look like, how we want to accommodate trading, and if we do want to accommodate trading, how we would allocate the allowances to the different utilities. We've got a lot of analysis that needs to be done, and then there's those early action credit programs that EPA has developed, and we're assuming that our utilities are going to want to make those available, and so we'll have to figure out how to implement those as well. I think we haven't really done a full analysis of what this plan requires. We don't have an idea of what it's going to take to comply with it specifically, but in general, it looks like because of the way EPA has changed this that the actions that our utilities are already planning to take to comply with existing state energy policy, as reflected by their recently filed integrated resource plans, are going to get us very close to what we need to do. It's probably not going to be everything, but it's going to be very close. So we're looking at tweaking more than building something from scratch.
Thank you for your testimony. I will go to questions from members of the committee. Representative Neuberger and Representative Scott. So Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Thornton. I had a question for you early on in your presentation. You had spoke about a catastrophic failure with Sherco 3. To your knowledge, were there any fatalities or was there any evacuation that was required due to that catastrophic failure?
I'm pretty sure there weren't any injuries, but I don't know about evacuation. I'm sure we're probably inside the plant.
Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Commissioner Thornton, I live here. I live 1 mile downwind from the plant, and I ask this question just as a testimony to how safe coal is. We had This occurred, and I heard about it days later in the local paper. If there had been an evacuation, we would have been evacuated. I will say this. There are many forms of energy that we can use for public utilities, but all of them seem to have consequences. If there's a nuclear mishap, it's catastrophic, and we don't even want to think about what could happen. If there's a natural gas a line rupture, or if you have a train that derails, we're talking about entire communities could be basically destroyed. What do you do when a coal train goes off the tracks? We get out a broom and we sweep it up. So as a testimony to the safety of coal, and we talk about the social cost of carbon, we also have to remember that there's nothing safer than coal when it comes to a fuel source.
As a general rule, the House does not allow senators to speak, but this is Senator Brown's district, and he has asked for a question.
Mr. Chairman, could I respond just briefly?
Commissioner Thornton, absolutely. Yes. Commissioner Thornton.
Thank you for bringing that up. When I used the word catastrophic, I was thinking in terms of the ability of the plant to operate, not how it affected the community or might have affected the community. The turbine blew up or something like that, and they couldn't make power for a year, or over a year, actually. So that's what I was referring to as catastrophic. I should have used a different word.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting someone from the other body speak in your committee. I appreciate that. Mr. Thornton, to the testifier, Mr. Thornton, in your second slide, I believe it was, the one titled Minnesota's Issues Addressed, you had one of your key points being environmental justice. Could you give definition to what you mean by environmental justice and give some practical examples of what that would look like?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, in context to this issue, the Clean Power Plan, EPA has asked that states do some additional public outreach in communities of color and lower income to make sure that they have an opportunity to participate in the process of developing our state plan. And that's the main thing that's required. There is also a desire to do some analysis to show how implementing a plan that a state develops and submits will impact public health and the environment. That's something that is also connected to that.
Please continue, Commissioner Thornton.
I was done, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Senator Brown, is that it? Representative Scott.
Okay, is it on? Yeah, there we go. Thank you. Senator, you stole one of my questions, but I have a couple more. Secondly, aren't other states parties in lawsuits right now against the Clean Power Plan and 111D? And do you happen to know the status of those lawsuits? Have any of those been withdrawn since this rehashing of the Clean Power Plan?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, there are a number of states that have indicated that they will be suing EPA, but the final rule has not been published in the Federal Register, so courts would not consider anything filed until then as timely. So we understand that EPA is probably not going to have this published in the Federal Register until around the end of September, and I think that's when all of the legal paperwork is going to start being filed. I would imagine there'll be about 15 or so states that sue EPA, and there'll probably be another 10 to 15 states that file to support EPA.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what was our goal prior to the revamping of the 111D? Wasn't it in the 40 percentile, and now we're still at, what is it, 42 now still? What was it before?
Representative Scott, do you mean the what was our CO2
target? Our target, our target for Minnesota.
Commissioner Thornton, do you know what our target was before and what it is compared to now?
That's a great question. And the problem is that it would be trying to compare apples to nuts because EPA completely redid how the formula works and what goes into it. And it's really difficult to compare the two. What we have done and what my comments to you at the end here about how much of a lift this might be for us was what we did was look at the ton amount that we're going to have to be meeting by 2030, which is around 23 million tons of greenhouse gases a year, and to look at where the integrated resource plans and other things that our utilities are doing will accomplish between now and then, and we get very close to that number, and that's why I made the comments that I made at the end. And it's certainly our feeling that this final plan is less restrictive in Minnesota, but we didn't have the ability to compare a mass target like we do now, and so it's really hard to be very specific about that.
Representative Scott, last question.
Last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you kind of decipher for folks in the audience and for us, we committee chair people that or committee people that don't completely understand the difference between the rate versus mass? Can you give us a brief explanation of what each of those really means?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, mass is, I'll just use the phrase, cap and trade. It's like capping emissions at a certain number, and because EPA will allow for trading to achieve that number in a flexible way, it could best be thought of in that way. And that's much easier for people to understand. A rate target means that all of the utilities in Minnesota would have to meet a certain pound of CO2 per megawatt hour target collectively. And that would mean we would have to do a lot of fancy math figuring out how much different units would be able to operate under the different conditions that they are able to operate under to be able to determine what kind of a rate target, what a rate target would mean here and how to implement and how to enforce something like that. So we haven't decided which approach to take. One is a lot easier on the mind than the other, but we want to thoroughly vet both paths and do what looks like the right thing for Minnesota, the best choice for Minnesota.
Question, other questions from members of the committee? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Thornton, I'm hoping that Minnesota will be one of the states that joins in the lawsuit against the EPA and the implementation of the Clean Power Plan.
For members of the public, I understand we're in public and this is an important issue and we certainly want people's feedback. And generally, when we're having committee hearings at the Capitol, we try to discourage feedback and applause or booing or hissing. I've tried to give wide discretion on people with differences of opinion, but really, this is a committee hearing, and if going forward, you know, restrain yourselves and try to keep your inner emotions inside. That would be very helpful. And again, just because not picking one side or another is just generally the decorum in the committee is we don't do that. So I have tried to cut people some slack, and I would hate for our law enforcement professionals to have to discourage you from applauding. I don't think they really want to do that. So Representative Fabian, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate the applause. It's the first I've had since Saturday morning at the Veterans Club in Middle River. So, but Commissioner Thornton, you said that some would join in and some would join the lawsuit supporting the EPA and some would be against the EPA. It's my understanding that that's for the administration to decide. Have you made a decision?
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner Thornton.
Our Constitution leaves that up to the Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be for you, Mr. Chair, maybe, but on the one slide, it's 2016 initial state plan submittal, request for extension. What's the legislature's role in that process?
We will...
Commissioner Thornton.
Oh, sorry, sir. Mr. Chairman, we are obligated to bring you a draft plan in March of next year, and we will bring whatever we have ready at that point in time, and we will be ready and willing to communicate with you as often as you want as we begin developing the elements of a plan, but the actual plan is an administrative function.
Any other questions from members?
One, real quick, Mr. Chair.
Last question, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the diagram of the states that you've got there, the Minnesota, North and South Dakota, and so forth, you talked a little bit about North Dakota's change there. What will be the effect on rates in North Dakota as a result of this?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, I don't know. I think they're probably wrestling with that right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, when I live where I live, much of our power does come from North Dakota. So if this results in an increase in rates in North Dakota through the MnCOTA network, it's going to cause an increase of rates in Northwest Minnesota. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, one follow-up on that. We recognize that because about a little less than a third of Minnesotans get their power from North Dakota. And so what North Dakota does to comply with their plan has a big impact on Minnesota ratepayers. And we have already been in contact with North Dakota. We want to be involved in their process. We want to make sure that Minnesota ratepayers get a fair shake in what they do.
Thank you. Any other questions for members of the committee? Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative, let's wait till we get the microphone to you. 1 second. Representative Wagenius.
We haven't discussed some of the benefits for public health. Will you be quantifying those as you submit your draft plan in March?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, that is our intention to do that.
Thank you.
Representative Wagenius. Any other questions from members of the committee? Commissioner, I have a couple of quick questions. Number one, first of all, I want to compliment the MPCA on soliciting input and for actually being here tonight. I think it would have been really easy to the MPCA just to skip out and not come out here. So I want to thank you for being here and listening, whether you agree or disagree with the comments you'll hear. So thank you for doing that. But Commissioner, my primary concern is not over who gets to talk or who gets to listen. It's over who gets to decide. And my question is, with regards to these rules, who decides them?
It would be the administration and the governor.
Okay. And with regards to that, with the administration and the governor, certainly they can listen to us and they can solicit public testimony, but does the administration view that they need any legislative approval to do any of the items that are being discussed tonight?
We're not aware of any that is required at this point. It's conceivable as we get further into the process of developing a state plan, we may find some elements that do require legislative approval.
So, Commissioner, would I be correct in saying then, we talked earlier about a trading system, a trading of credits, and what that would involve is emissions credits that were in surplus could be sold to another utility. For example, Minnesota could sell its credits to a utility in North Dakota where Minnesota ratepayers would then have higher energy prices to pay for those credits. That energy tax would not require legislative approval?
I'm not aware, Mr. Chairman, that if we go down the path of availing ourselves of the trading that EPA has set up in their plan, that legislative approval would be required for that.
And Commissioner, in terms of if some of the credits were to flow into public coffers, would the MPCA need the legislature's approval to spend that money, or would the MPCA just spend that on their own?
I believe in that case, the MPCA would require legislative approval.
With regards to the early action, if we could go back to the slide on early action. There we go. So as everyone knows, before 2012, Minnesota ratepayers spent billions of dollars to replace a couple of coal-fired power plants and run them on natural gas. And I'm seeing here in the notes that it says states with a less carbon-intensive power sector have less to do. Now, I'm not aware of us getting credit for those billions of dollars that we spent. Am I mistaken? Was there a change?
There is not a direct one-for-one credit in the final plan.
Okay, so do we get credit for it? Let's just say in a parallel universe, we didn't do that. We kept those coal-fired power plants.
Our target would be more restrictive, and we'd have more to do probably to meet the 2030 goal than we do right now. Wind and energy efficiency actions that have been taken will accrue as part of our ability to meet the target.
But, Commissioner, with regards to, again, Minnesota ratepayers have spent billions of dollars on this already. When I look at this, when I look at the federal power plant, the clean power plan, Minnesota's getting punished because we cleaned up our environment, and the only reason the federal government isn't counting it is because the federal government didn't tell us to do it. We figured it out on our own, and now we're getting punished for it. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, I wouldn't use the word punished. And we're being treated equally with all the other states. It's a level playing field. In fact, one way of looking at this is that's what EPA has done, is leveled the playing field among the states between those like Minnesota that have taken action early and those that have not.
I guess, Commissioner, I don't view states that did nothing getting treated the same as us, Minnesotans who spent billions of dollars, getting treated the same, as necessarily being fair. Fair is it's a subjective objection, but I would say that. Before I go to Representative Wagenius for a question, my final comment on this is that I understand it's not your decision, but the feedback you can give the administration, the idea that an energy tax can be levied on Minnesotans without a legislative approval and can be done by executive action is such a ridiculous notion, I can't believe I actually have to discuss it in this committee. That's not your decision. I don't take it out on you. But there's a reason why a carbon tax and an energy tax and cap and trade didn't pass at the federal level through the legislature. There was not legislative approval for it, so they did it administratively. The idea that the entire legislature, that the people all of us represent on a bipartisan basis, that we have no decision-making process in this, and that Governor Dayton gets to decide this. Furthermore, that the next governor can just automatically overrule his actions with executive action, that's not the rule of law. And that's how we end up getting in trouble. So if you can deliver that message, I know it's not your decision. I thank you for being here tonight, because it would have been really easy just to send a flyer or a video message. But I cannot emphasize that enough. And I think on that point, you're going to hear members of both parties. Legislators don't like having their authority getting stepped on, regardless of who the executive is. So if you could deliver that message, I'd appreciate it. But Representative Wagenius, you get the last question.
I just want to go back to the conversion of High Bridge and Riverside and the notion that we were actually getting punished for that. Those of us who live in those communities gained immensely in terms of health care costs. In fact, that was one of the things that pushed the conversion over, was the high health care costs and that they would be reduced. So we were net gainers in that.
But Representative Aguinas, that's not my point. My point is we are having to do twice what other states only have to do once. And our businesses compete against other states. So why are we being forced to do twice what Wisconsin, Iowa, North and South Dakota, Montana only have to do once? Representative Aguinas.
Thank you. That is not what I heard from Commissioner Thornton.
Commissioner Thornton, would you like to clarify this point?
I can only
you
say.
You can just say I'm right. That'd be a really quick answer. That's all right.
I'm mostly right. How's that? Again, I think that one of the things that EPA has tried to accomplish in what they've done at the final with this final plan is level the playing field between those states that have already taken action and spent some money and those states that haven't. And it's obviously too early to see how successful that will be. But as states start developing their plans, we'll find out more.
And so, Commissioner Thornton, I want to thank you for being here. I appreciate you taking the questions and answering them, so we appreciate that. Next up is Mike Beard. After that, we'll hear a video message from Congressman Emmer, and then we are going to have, it appears to be, some additional testifiers. Two Sherburne County commissioners, you're on deck after the Emmer message. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Mike Beard. I'm appearing before you tonight on behalf of the Coalition for a Secure Energy Future. I got to tell you, sitting in the audience and listening to the give and take, especially with Commissioner Thornton, I miss this. I wish I was up here with you because I had 64 more questions I'd have peppered him with if the chair would have indulged me. Nonetheless, I am one of two co-spokespersons for the Coalition for a Secure Energy Future. I'm privileged to serve with my former colleague, Senator Roger Moe, and myself. We've been asked to serve as spokespersons for the Secure Energy Future with our friends from the Lignite Council in North Dakota and a host of others who are members of the coalition, who are here to stress a point. We're not going to debate the merits of some of the things we just heard about, although, boy, I'd sure love to. But we're here to talk about why an all-of-the-above energy policy makes such common sense as we move forward, especially in this brave new world. And I recognize as I sit here and implore you to keep coal as an important part of our baseload energy going forward, that you may not have a lot to say about that. And I got to tell you, as 12 years as an elected official serving with you guys and now as a county commissioner in Scott County, that troubles me a great deal, that this has come out of our hands and gone to an administrative bureaucracy which is making this up on the fly, particularly when some of us voted specifically against things like cap and trade. Even the United States Congress did that. Now, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm already way off the track here on my prepared remarks, but I just had to get that off my chest. When we're looking at a common sense energy policy, north of the 45th parallel, where it's cold and dark 6 months of the year, we need reliable baseload power, not intermittent stuff that we want to try to incentivize and we want to try to find the bottom and help it find its place. I get all that. This legislature has done that over the last 20 years. But at the end of the day, if the plant across the street goes away, we're in big trouble. We are. The technology does not exist to replace coal-fired power in this state or anywhere in this country. Biomass included, I have a fantastic biomass facility in the heart of Shakopee. Wonderful facility, very expensive, very persnickety to run. We're pretty proud of it. We're trying to work it out. But that does not replace it. None of this replaces what Mother Nature gave us in our natural resources in coal, gas, and uranium. I could probably end my remarks right there, but staff worked really hard to give these 3 pages a talking point, so if you'll bear with me, I'm going to try to get back on task and skim through them. I've already made the point that we need to enhance, preserve, and protect our diverse set of resources, coal-based electricity. Yes, we don't mine it in Minnesota, but our neighbors do, and they send it over here, and we convert it into useful power that powers our farms, our shops, and our homes, and our businesses. As we've been traveling around the state talking about these things, the Rotary Clubs, Chambers of Commerce, and other interested civic groups, we thought we would just conduct some public opinion polling to see what people out there outside of the echo chamber in St. Paul are really thinking about our energy policy. What we found with our polling is that 77% of Minnesotans thinks that Minnesota and the United States needs an all-of-the-above. We're happy to play around the edges with the new emerging technologies, wind, solar, biomass, things like that. But they recognize that if we're going to run paper mills and plywood factories, if we're going to convert natural resources into iron or steel, if we're going to make ethanol, we're going to process food and add value in this state. That takes copious amounts of baseload power, and the baseload power had better be there 24 hours a day, and it better be priced somewhere under 5 cents a kilowatt hour, or these businesses can't do business in this state. I know it wasn't entirely responsible for it, but we've lost two paper mills in this state in the last 18 months. They are enormous users of electrical power. We almost lost one in Shakopee, a big paper conversion facility, over 2 cents a kilowatt hour in the price jump, because that's the biggest part of their cost of doing business, electrical energy. We found that 88% of the Minnesotans say that coal-produced power makes electricity more affordable, more reliable, and helps keep big businesses that employ people at great wages open in this state. According to the U.S. Information Energy Administration, coal is now down to 46% of the electrical output in this state. When I was first elected in 2002, it was about 54%. Part of that came from the MERP program that Representative Wagenius just referred to, where we converted two very large plants to natural gas. Some of it came from the recession. Some of it came just from businesses reworking their motors, their lights, and doing energy efficiency things. Most of it, though, I would submit, had to do with the Great Recession we just wandered through, because our coal power growth, for the first time in history, is not going up. It's flat to declining, and that makes a big difference in how things are priced going forward when we're trying to experiment with renewable energy sources and trying to work them into a baseload system that was designed to run full bore 24 hours a day and deliver very inexpensive, very reliable baseload power. There's some other threats on the horizon. We just heard a great presentation by Commissioner Thornton on the EPA's Clean Power Program. We're concerned about the impact it's going to have on our state. Several research reports have been done, and Mr. Chairman, I have footnotes at the end of my thing. I can make them available to the committee if you wish, rather than read them all off. But the Heritage Foundation did a pretty extensive report and found that nearly 15,000 jobs would be at risk just in Minnesota alone because of the increased cost of electricity at the industrial level. If you include the entire upper Midwest, which is pretty much the MISO footprint, we all know what the MISO footprint is, we're running the risk of 45,000 jobs being lost at full implementation. And we're not losing them to other regions of the country, we're losing them to other regions of the world. And that's kind of what we're up against here. These costs significantly impact critical business decisions like relocation, new employees, expansion, or determining where to locate a plant or a facility. If I can just have a sidebar here for a minute and talk about the implementation of this plan and how we're busy patting ourselves on the back for work that we've already done and how we kind of got credit for it in the second round of the draft. I want to talk about our cousins over in North Dakota and what's happening to them, how theirs spiked from 11 to 45. Before we get too celebratory about that, I want to remind you that a third of the power in this state comes from North Dakota on long-term contracts that aren't subject to the coal moratorium, but nonetheless the price inflators are there because most of our co-ops and our municipals buy their power from people in North and South Dakota. So before we celebrate the fact that we've done so well, I want you to remember that we all pay. The MISO grid is interconnected, folks. There isn't a circuit breaker at the Red River that we can throw and keep their power over there and we'll keep our power over here. It doesn't work that way. I had to get that off my chest. Thank you for letting me do that. Specifically, we're concerned about what's going to happen with our buying patterns, about the impact on households in particular. You know, the term environmental justice was thrown around. Somebody, thank you for asking that question. Whenever I see terms like equity and justice, I always hold on to my wallet because there's no clear definition and it can get very expensive. But I want to tell you about the people I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about the neighbors sitting behind me that work in these places, not just this power plant, but I'm thinking about the lumber mill. I'm thinking about the steel fabrication. I'm thinking about the steel mill in St. Paul, the largest, second largest user of electrical power in this state. I'm talking about Rock 10 that converts recycled cardboard. If their prices go up even another penny, they're out of here. And that's something like 450 United Steelworker jobs that go with it. These are very serious concerns that I have with the effects of the Clean Power Plan and how it's going to impact our economy going forward. Last but not least, I want to talk about how we're giving away our leadership position in the world. People like Westinghouse and Bechtel used to own pollution control industry in this country. We have the cleanest coal-burning plants that can be found anywhere. The Japanese have taken that from us. They didn't steal it. They earned it. Whenever our country decided we were going to pressure the World Bank to stop building coal-fired power plants around the world, Japan stepped up and has financed over $20 billion worth of coal-fired power plants in Indochina and the South Pacific, even as far away as Chile and Argentina. And their engineering firms are outclassing ours now in emissions reductions and in pollution control equipment. These are not the 50-megawatt stinkers that China was building a generation ago. These are ultra-supercritical power plants with up to 45% thermal efficiency and emissions that are cleaner than you could ever imagine. And we've given that industry away. Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude my remarks with that. Stand for a few questions if you wish. But I'm here to tell you that we at the Coalition for a Secure Energy Future wish we would reassert ourselves when it comes to responsible baseload power. Remember that we need to be reliable, inexpensive, and high quality if we're going to continue to have a way of life where it snows and where the sun goes down at 4:30.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee? Representative Hortman.
I don't know if it's on. Okay. I was wondering what Coalition for a Secure Energy Future is. I saw a photograph of where you and lobbyist Joel Johnson and lobbyist Roger Moe had given an award to a legislator, and then it was on behalf of Coalition for a Secure Energy Future, and then I looked up on the registrations of the firms that were legally entitled to lobby legislators in Minnesota, and I didn't see that listed, and I didn't see that any of you were listed as lobbyists for that organization. So I was wondering today, are you here as a paid lobbyist for Coalition for a Secure Energy Future? Are they registered in Minnesota, and are they legally entitled to lobby the legislature?
Mr. Beard.
Mr. Chairman, I shall not attempt to use the word lobbyist more times than my former colleague did. You were out of the room whenever I explained the Coalition for a Secure Energy Future. Former Senator Roger Moe and I are the spokespersons for that. We make public appearances like this. We do not lobby the legislature. In this regard, I have some other clients I work with on some other things unrelated to this issue, but as you've known from my 12 years of work on the Energy Committee, this is something I know something about and I believe in. There are apparently paid lobbyists, but I'm not sure about how that registration works or when it took effect and when you looked that up. But no, I am not a lobbyist.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo.
For this cause.
Mr. Beard, I was just wondering if you were paid by them to appear today.
Mr. Beard.
I do get an honorarium for being a spokesperson for the Coalition for a Secure Energy Future. Yes, I do.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, what's the difference between somebody who speaks to the legislature on behalf of an industry and a lobbyist?
Mr. Beard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, when I went to the Campaign Finance Board and said, I'm being asked to be a spokesperson and a figurehead for this organization. I will be speaking to these people. Does this constitute lobbying? And they said, are you going to be basically seeing legislators in favor of or against certain legislation? And I said, no, I'm here to come and speak at things like this and Rotary Chamber, et cetera. They said, no, you're not a lobbyist. If you take up legislation in a cause for or against or attempt to influence, then I would be a lobbyist.
Representative Hortman.
Just a final question then.
I have a question for you. Who cares?
Well, I'm just wondering, you know, Minnesotans.
Hold on. Just, we cannot. No feedback, please, on both sides. Representative Hortman, go ahead.
Well, Minnesotans would like to know who's paying people to come and see their legislators and who's paying people to make statements to the legislature. And Minnesotans are also legally entitled to know who is making campaign expenditures. And I'm thinking that if this organization, the Coalition for a Secure Energy Future, doesn't register their lobbying activities with the Campaign Finance Board, then Minnesotans are likely to have no idea what amount of spending they do on campaigns, where their contributions come from, or any of those public disclosures that we expect
from our clean campaigning in Minnesota, and I just think it's a real change in direction. It's not something I've ever seen at the legislature.
Representative Hortman, when you chaired the committee, did you have testifiers from other environmental organizations who had a role, such as Mr. Beard? Representative Hortman?
Mr. Chair, anytime I had a lobbyist speak in front of my committee, they were registered with the Campaign Finance Board.
How about spokespersons, Representative Hortman?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe we had any spokespeople who were not registered at the Campaign Finance Board.
You did. Well, but you and I, we'll discuss it over a beer later on. So I think the important thing is Mr. Beard's role and this organization's role is no different than several environmental organizations. We're not hearing, I don't believe any of them are scheduled on our list to testify tonight, but there's nothing unique about this organization compared to other ones. But I'll give you the last word, Representative Hortman.
I just would ask you, Representative Garofalo, do you think Minnesotans are entitled to know who's trying to buy their elections?
Well, Representative Hortman, I think certainly that disclosure applies on every single issue. There's nothing specific about Representative Mr. Beard or this organization. It's the same practice. No laws have been changed since when you chaired this committee. So I think whatever standards being applied to Mr. Beard should certainly be applied to environmental environmental groups. And I think when the legislature meets this session, I think I'm going to, your line of questioning, I think I will apply to many of the testifiers that come before our committee. And I think we'll both agree that's fair. Any other questions from members of the committee? Thank you, Representative Mr. Beard. Thank you for being here. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Fabian. That'll be it, though, and then we're going to go to the video message from Congressman Emmer. And then on deck, the two Sherburne County Commissioners, if you could just be ready. Thank you, Mr. Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Beard, thanks for being here this evening. It's always a pleasure to hear your perspective on things.
Thank you.
Just a couple of things real quick. He talked about the need of baseload electricity and how important it is. I was recently at a gathering, and Senator David Tomasoni was there from up on the Iron Range. And he told the group that was gathered there how important the taconite industry is to northeastern Minnesota. But he also talked about the energy needs of the taconite industry. Their number one cost driver in the taconite industry is the cost of power. That's their number one expense. And they're extremely concerned about ongoing increasing costs. But to put into perspective how much power is required to run one taconite plant, just one plant, one taconite plant in northeastern Minnesota requires as much electricity as the entire city of Bloomington to run it 24/7, 365. And you folks, you can go and look online too. Talking about clean air and so forth, and Mr. Beard was talking about North Dakota. The American Lung Association has given counties in western North Dakota, where the coal-fired plants are located, a grade of A for air quality. So a tremendous amount of work has been done in the industry to clean things up, and I just want to point that out, that I think that that's really cool. You also talked real briefly about biomass. Mm-hmm. People, I live in northwestern Minnesota. We have a couple of companies up there that make outdoor wood-burning furnaces. And EPA is proposing new rules on those. It's driving the costs of those wood-burning furnaces in a very, very sparsely populated area up by a few thousand dollars, and what's making it cost prohibitive for many people to use a naturally occurring biomass wood, a renewable that we can use, but it's making it more and more difficult to use those to heat their homes, their shops, their barns, and so forth. So thank you.
Mr. Beard, final word?
Last word. Thank you. Since my reputation is being assailed, this is typical what I find from my friends on the environmental left, and I'm being really blunt right now. When they don't want to attack the issue and talk about the issue, they can somehow draw the whole thing about, try to taint the whole thing about me being here as a paid representative for an industry group that's trying to make a point that we just need to sustain baseload power. There also are different types of lobbying organizations, Mr. Chairman and members. Those that make donations to caucuses and members, those that run flyers for and against an issue, those that will go out and campaign on behalf of or against a member. The organization I represent does none of the above. We talk about the need for coal being a baseload power. You're having a hearing next to the largest coal-based power plant in the upper Midwest, the third or fourth largest in the state or the nation. I thought it was important we just came and made our presentation, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to do that, and I'm happy to stand on my credentials and talk about our organization, which is upstanding, outstanding, and a credible organization to be talking about these issues. Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Beard. We'll go now to a video message from Congressman Emmer. Do you need the microphone over there first to hear it or not?
To our economy, and especially to the Becker area. Unfortunately, I'm unable to be with you this evening, but I wanted to send this message to echo the concerns of our state legislators here tonight in their opposition to the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan and the impact this new executive action will have on Sherco, where you are all sitting right now, and the surrounding communities that I represent. All of you here tonight are rightly concerned about our runaway federal government. We're stuck in a cycle where all too often confusing rules are crafted by unelected and unaccountable bureaucrats. A perfect example of this is the exact reason this hearing is being held, the Clean Power Plan. Last month, President Obama announced the final Clean Power Plan, which will structurally remake our nation's energy infrastructure without a single committee hearing or vote in Congress. The president seems intent upon making his infamous words, energy prices will necessarily skyrocket, a reality. Despite the president's actions over the past 7 years, the U.S. has become a global energy leader, allowing Americans to benefit every day at the pump and through their energy bills. But this could all change at the expense of families here in Minnesota and across the United States. Just as we are on the cusp of being an energy powerhouse with an all-of-the-above energy approach, the president appears to want to slow it down. The Clean Power Plan will benefit few, if any, while leaving the potential to crush entire economies and industries, forcing consumers, municipalities, and existing power plants like Sherco, which powers homes, schools, and businesses, to completely transform in less than 15 years. In the 6th Congressional District, where you're sitting today, manufacturing is one of the largest drivers of our economy. Analysis conducted by the Heritage Foundation earlier this year showed that Minnesota could lose more than 10,000 manufacturing jobs as a result of the president's Clean Power Plan. While jobs will be lost and Minnesota families will be forced to face increasing energy costs, facts and the EPA itself indicate that the Clean Power Plan's overall impact on climate will be minimal at best. According to the Cato Institute, the change will be less than 0.02 of a degree Celsius in the next 85 years. Like all Minnesotans, I agree that we must have responsible and environmentally friendly policies to maintain our beautiful land and streams for future generations, while still allowing for maximum economic benefit. One of the major problems with the president's Clean Power Plan is that there are huge economic costs without defined environmental benefits. I applaud Chairman Garofalo and again Representative Neuberger and all other members of the Minnesota legislature in this effort to work with Governor Dayton to oppose the president's Clean Power Plan and to work towards solutions that will maintain our environment while preserving good jobs and keeping energy costs low for Minnesota families and businesses. Again, thank you for holding this hearing, and please, don't hesitate to contact me with any questions or concerns or if there's anything I can do to assist in your efforts. Thanks.
Our next testifiers are County Commissioner, and I don't want to butcher your last name, it's John Rebel and Felix Schmiesing. And this is a reminder, folks, Mr. David Fitzsimmons from Congressman Emmer's office, I think he's still here. If you have any questions, he's representing Congressman Emmer's office. You can speak with him afterwards. Welcome to the committee. Please state your names for the record.
I am Sherburne County Commissioner John Rebel, representing the Becker area.
Felix Schmiesing, Sherburne County Commissioner, representing an area just north of Johns, right next door.
And I forgot to add, I'm also a business person in this community. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Neuberger for continuing to bring this important issue to the attention of our community and your fellow legislators. And I would thank Becker City for hosting this hearing. We have heard how central Sherco is to our community from a financial standpoint. Well, let's put it this way or another way. It would take approximately 450 businesses valued at $1 million each to generate the same amount of property taxes currently paid by the Sherco facility. Any reduction to that facility's output and corresponding loss of taxable value will force our city, schools, and our county to cut services, levy additional property taxes, or even both. Sherco and its parent company have long been good corporate partners and neighbors. They have been active in our community constantly. A portion of Sherco's property is leased to the city as a public park and boat launch. They are also involved in philanthropic ventures throughout the area and contribute to the community's resources, talent, and their generosity. Sherco leadership works very well with our community leaders on local issues and economic development efforts. It also provides support for technical programs at our local high school, community colleges, and our state university. In addition, Sherco supports our local fire departments with training, safety gear, and equipment, and many employees serve as volunteer firefighters in various communities in this region. Employees also give in other ways, such as giving blood, delivering meals, helping build houses, and raising money for the United Way. And every year since 1992, Sherco employees have joined other community volunteers up and down the river in a Mississippi River cleanup day to volunteer and clean up and remove junk and debris discarded or washed ashore in our river system. I appreciate you hearing me.
Yes, thank you all for coming. Representative Neuberger, thanks for setting this up. We appreciate it. I'll clear things up right away. I am not a paid lobbyist, and it'll be abundantly clear by the time I'm done speaking why. I just want to, we've listened to just so many figures and so many numbers here.
Sir, if you could you bring the microphone a little bit closer to you?
We've spoken about so many figures and so many numbers here that I have to take a little different tilt at this. I'm 62 years old. I know I don't look a day over 70. But at any rate, I just want to talk about a neighboring community. I live in Clear Lake, grew up and farmed there north of Clear Lake all of my life. Back in the day when I was in high school, Becker was a wide spot in the road. There was a couple of streets here. I think that the service road was gravel, if I remember correctly. I went to school in Clear Lake, a little three-room school, and then we graduated to the big school, went to St. Cloud. We thought we were privileged because we were a little larger community. I think at that time, Clear Lake had about 30 more people than Becker. Between the two of them, they probably didn't have 500. Then came the opportunity for a power plant to locate. Now, this power plant was shopped around. I don't think it was welcome everywhere that they tried to take it, but it did fit here. It was controversial with this community. It was there was a lot of discussion, and it was placed here because the majority thought it was important that it be here. So they've been here. They've been a huge factor in this local economy. They've been a huge factor in our county economy, and they have been an economic engine for us for over 40 years now. I think that this community took the risk. I think the risk takers get the reward. They should not be denied this power plant. This should continue. The transmission lines are here. We're on a pile of coal here. There's no single solution to this problem. I think it would be just completely irresponsible for you to punish a community that stepped up and did their part over 40 years ago. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for members of the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have the mayor of Becker, Mr. Kleiss, the mayor of Clear Lake, and then Mr. Gunners, the mayor of Clear Lake, and then the city administrator for the city of Monticello, Mr. O'Neill. If we could have all three of you come up to the table at the same time, please. Or is it just you to the other two not here?
Well, I seen Tim earlier. Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Gunner or Mr. O'Neill? And I think what we're going to do here is, I know that before we said we were going to have people just, people who had asked to testify, we would put them on the list, but I do think it's important that, I think there's some people here who are actually opposed to Sherco and want to see it close. I think I'd like to hear a couple, some testimony from a couple of those people to get their perspective so that the, make sure we have that, although they did, none of them contacted us to testify in advance, but that's fine. I'll just waive the rule to have a couple testifiers. So if there's a couple people who want to see Sherco or are opposed to that or are supportive of the clean power plan, I think we'll take one, two, or three testifiers depending upon the amount of questions. So we'll do that after Mr. Kleiss's testimony right here. So welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. This is a little nerve-wracking for me, but I'm glad I wrote my name down so I remember it. I am Mayor Jerome Kleiss. I also go by Lefty. It's a nickname I've had for 49 years. My dad's name is also Jerome, so it's good that I have a good nickname. Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to thank the House Jobs and Energy Committee, along with Representative Jim Neuberger, for the opportunity to have this conversation on this important topic tonight. As you can imagine, the Sherburne County Generating Station, or Sherco plant, is the primary economic driver for the city of Becker. Xcel Energy's Sherco plant provides jobs for local residents, contributes to local tax revenue, and supports our local schools, police, and fire services. The steam from Sherco is sold to Liberty Paper, also a major employer in Becker, for its operations. Loss of energy jobs will directly and significantly impact Becker, Liberty Paper, and surrounding communities. In fact, loss of energy, the energy, will severely impact our region. The Sherco plan is much more than a local economic engine. It's a cornerstone to our regional economy. The 2,400 megawatts produced by the Sherco plant is enough power to provide about 2 million homes with low-cost electricity. Xcel Energy and the Sherco plant are also excellent community partners and supporters. For example, the Sherco plant's recent fundraiser raised about $78,000 for United Way. In addition, the Sherco plant hosts interns from our local high school every year. They sponsor local robotics team, participate in multiple chambers of commerce. They attend local business expos, coordinate the Mississippi River cleanup, and sponsors Wounded Warrior activities, just to name a few of the functions Xcel Energy and Sherco sponsor or are involved with. One of the questions that remain unanswered is, what's the impact to the fastest growing segment of our population, the aging baby boomers? As you may know, the 65 and over population is currently the fastest growing age group. Between 2000 and 2030, the 65 and over population will increase from 12% to 24%. Of the total state population, or about one in every four Minnesotans. That equals a doubling of the older population from 600,000 to 1.2 million. In closing, I'd like to point out the great working relationship we have with Xcel Energy and management at the Sherco plant and the desire to continue that partnership. Again, I would like to thank the House Jobs and Energy Committee and Representative Neuberger for the opportunity to tell our story. Mr. Chair, I'd like to apologize ahead of time for this comment, but as the mayor of this city, and I am the head of the city.
I'm always concerned when people lead with an apology. Just so you know, I'm always, so I'm curious where this goes. Mr. Mayor.
It's real clean. I don't have the big ball, but the gentleman right here, if he'd stand up. Becker does power Minnesota, and we are proud of it. Right there. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for members of the committee? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Mayor. Again, what we'll do, I don't know if we have a couple of testifiers who want to voice concerns about the power plant. I do want, please come to the table, miss. Oh, do you have a list right there? Do you have people who, or okay, if you come up. And I just want to reassure, for those members, people who did call and sign up to testify in advance, you will get your testimony done tonight. Again, the number of sort of people we're letting cut to the front of the line here is dependent upon how many questions members have and how quick their testimony is. So, Miss, did you wish to testify? Thank you. And if you could, either before your testimony or the conclusion of it, please sign in to it.
I will do that. Thank you.
Yep. And so welcome to the committee. Please state your name and
yes,
where you're from.
I'm Maureen McCarter. I'm from St. Cloud. And you know what my concern? I'm not here to tell you, you know, what to do with the Sherco plant. But what is disturbing to me is that you would begin a hearing like this with a very biased presentation and not balance that with information, for example, first of all, telling the individuals here present tonight that the gentleman who spoke from the Manhattan Institute to make sure that they knew that that is supported financially in part by the Koch brothers, who have an interest in coal industry, oil industry. That's very clear. I think that should have been a disclosure that was made right up front. Secondly, that gentleman in that same presentation used the red herring that the United States has cut its emissions, CO2 emissions, by so much more than anybody else, and that by cutting it any more is not going to save the climate. But that what that individual did not cite is that in 2011, and you can check this information at the worldbank.org website, the United States was number one in metric tons per capita that was emitted into the atmosphere. A metric ton is roughly a little over 2,000 pounds. Our nearest competitor for that top position was China, with 6 metric tons per capita. So we produce 3 times as much per person emissions that are sent up into the atmosphere. And carbon dioxide, as we all know, stays in the atmosphere for 100 years, for a century. So whatever we emit today or tomorrow, we could stop every single emission of CO2, and that, what's been up there, is going to have an effect for 100 years. So the way he kept saying something about we can't do anything more, whatever we would do that is more would be a drop in the bucket, is so wrong and so misleading. And I don't know who on the committee decided that that was appropriate to show. I understand that this is a legislative committee, and if anything, I would assume that a legislative committee would present information to its constituents and to the public that was balanced. My final comment is going to be this. There is a report, you can read it in Nature magazine, it's very recent data that shows that air pollution kills 3.3 million people a year across the globe. Not all of that, of course, is from power plants, but in the central part of the country, it is. The emissions from power plants have the ability to harm our brains and contribute to strokes and to our hearts. So please, in the future, I would beg you to have a ask persons from various parts of the community and with varying perspectives testify. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And just first of all, any questions from members of the committee? Miss, just I have a quick question for you, or maybe two once you're done signing
up. Go ahead.
First of all, because you kind of questioned the agenda of the committee and what's happening, clearly we're in the site of the largest coal-fired power plant in the Midwest region. We're within a mile of it. It's reasonable to expect that we would want the workers, the managers, the owners, and the property taxpayers of this area to offer their opinions. Again, I decided that I thought it would be a good idea for those who were opposed to that power plant or want to see it closed or transitioned to change the rules so we could actually get a more balanced presentation. If you, I don't know how that can be ruled as unfair, but I would tell you that this is not the only hearing we're going to have on this issue. This is the only hearing we're going to have in Becker, but we're going to have other hearings around the state, and I certainly would invite you to participate in that process. In addition, speaking before a committee is only one way to give information. At any time, you are invited to submit written testimony to this committee, not you or any member of the public. We will gladly take that information and post it on the committee's website and make it available to members of the public. But I would tell you that certainly we can all disagree about, we have different views and different opinions on these issues, but it's a little bit insulting when you get up and say that I'm being unfair, especially when you're up here because I changed the rules so you could testify.
I appreciate your changing the rules, but the facts are still the facts.
Okay, well, with regards to the facts, you mentioned that basically that Sherco and the coal-fired power plants are killing people. Can you tell me what are those emissions that are resulting in death? What are the...
Some of it is there's sulfate emissions, and those sulfate emissions, and this is where we should have those experts here. I'm really sorry. The only reason that I'm sitting here right now is that you don't have them here.
So sulfur dioxide would be one of those...
Problems. Sulfates.
Okay. Can you give me some emissions that would come from the Sherco power plant that would meet
you
that
category?
You
know what? I am not an expert in this. I'm only up here because I felt what was being presented in that initial video was slanted.
From Congressman Emmer?
No.
So this is the
gentleman at the very beginning, you remember when you were having the difficulties getting the sound to work from the Manhattan Institute?
Yes.
Yes. I felt that the information that was presented in there was not totally balanced.
Okay, miss, I understand that. I'm just asking, what is the other information that is a more balanced perspective? What are those pollutants? I'm just asking, if you don't know, then just say it, that's fine. I'm just, what is that information? Because my understanding is that when it comes to particulate matter from the Sherco power plant, the current emissions controls in there are some of the nation's in the world's best. 99% of the particulate matter is trapped on site. Over two-thirds of the sulfur dioxide is captured on site. Nitrogen oxide is over 75%, so the pollutants that you're referring to may apply to coal-fired power plants in Ohio, but they don't apply to Sherco. And
so if you... That was my second point. My first point was, and I said it quite clearly, that the gentleman from the Manhattan Institute, which is an institute supported by the industry, right, painted a picture. He said several times that cutting our CO2 emissions wasn't going to make a difference, implying that, remember we said we want to save the climate, it's not going to help for us to reduce the CO2 emissions because of power plants that are going up elsewhere. But what he didn't clarify is that, well, we produce three times as much per capita as any other country after us, which is China. And I felt that that was not being accurate. All right? So that's why I wanted to correct that so that the persons in the audience understand what the worldview is. It's partially being responsible for each of our own behaviors and actions. So if my actions are contributing, they are. 17 metric tons that I produce a year. Right? So it's a part of being personally responsible for our actions, behaviors. And I just think that should be something that's part of the equation.
Thank you for clarifying the per capita target versus the mass-based target.
Right, and this was out of a report that was just reported on last week in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. And if you want to get the exact details on that, it is in the most recent issue of Nature magazine. We have had one of the persons here this evening, Representative, I assume, Wagenius, refer to the health benefits of closing the two plants in the Twin Cities area. And I don't know if she wants to elaborate more on that, but there is evidence out there that it does. I don't know. I hope that Becker's are at the very top of the list that in terms of cleaning up whatever is emitted. We know that that's not 100% clean, right? And we know our lakes in Minnesota, the reason we have alerts now for women as to how many fish and children as to how many fish they can eat per week is because of the mercury that is emitted from coal burning power plants.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate you sharing your opinions with us.
Thank
is there
you.
Another testifier who wishes to voice concerns about Miss, if you could come up, please? And ma'am, you'll be happy to know that in 2006, the state of Minnesota passed a bill to reduce mercury emissions from coal-fired power plants by over 90%. And every member of the legislature voted for it, which is just amazing. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and where you're from, and if you could just fill out the testifiers table so we know you're from. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, my name is Rose Thielen. I live in Clearwater Township. I'm a constituent of Representative Neuberger's, and I want to present my comments, but Mr. Representative Garofalo, I hope that you don't try and talk me out of them or, you know, kind of dispute them, because these are just my comments. And so I agree with Maureen when she suggested that it seemed a little one-sided, that it was about manufacturing consent, that we were here to hear from the point of view of a couple of conservative think tank representatives and then somebody who represents or is a organization that is funded by the North Dakota coal industry to tell us why we are going to be ruined if we don't support and rah-rah around coal. And as far as I know, I've got both signs on. I'm for Sherco, and I'm for clean energy. I don't know whoever put forward the equivalence that we are done if coal is no longer here. There is a clean energy industry. I have a letter here from Blattner Energy, who is a foremost leader in alternative energy, and he talks about all the new jobs that are available. If my representative, Neuberger, I beg you, start representing me. I was once a Wright County commissioner, and I heard the commissioners up here talking about what a wonderful company they are. That's beside the point. If they're a wonderful company and people are dying and the planet is suffering, that has to be part of the equation. If we can have the same number of good jobs in a clean energy industry, why wouldn't we? And you don't want to hear that. You just want to say, no, coal, 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 coal. And if you say that maybe there's another thing they could be burning there, or maybe there's another way they could have good jobs in a clean energy industry, then you're denounced as some sort of environmental freak. You know, so I am frightened by this display. It's so Orwellian. The silence is deafening around here. We got the commissioners trotting out how wonderful Sherco is. We got all the testimony from these people about how wonderful it all is and how wonderful coal is. You know, coal is killing us. Our planet is at a breaking point. One of the low-hanging fruits that currently exists for us in terms of air pollution is to look at coal-fired power plants. I think if you are going to represent me, and believe me, it's not just the people who are for this that are impacted by this. I mean, who are for looking at the health costs and looking at, let's look at the clean energy industry. Let's catch up here. It's affecting everybody, the people in the coal plants. Anyway, I won't go on and on, but I'm very concerned. I would like the other point of view. And Maureen isn't a scientist, but there's good scientists in the room. There's good scientists in the state who can talk to you about, we can do it. We have the technology. We can have the jobs. Blattner Industry talking about 119% increase in jobs, $71,000 median income. Why aren't you at the table with Xcel saying, okay, look, this coal, it's gone its way out, you know that. Let's make sure that we can transition so Becker can still have their little ball bin. They can still power Minnesota, but why does it have to be with coal? Who said? The only way we can do this is with coal, and if we don't, we're done. It's just like goofy to me. So, and, you know, thanks for being here. I completely support the workers in the plant. I probably support workers more in the plant than some of the people that are currently using them to promote the interests of the industry. You know, I would walk alongside them to assure that they have good paying jobs with pension in a clean energy industry. We don't need to continue to do this sort of destruction of people's health and the planet in order to fuel our homes. I have here, I'd like to submit it. The other thing, Jim, is bring the public health directors together from the four counties. Don't bring the commissioners. Bring the public health directors here to talk about what they know about asthma, heart disease, lung disease, breast cancer. You know, the Minnesota Department of Health put out this climate change profile 2015, and it talks about the health impacts of air pollution and water pollution. You know, so, you know, check it out. The information is out there. When people come to you in their office and try to tell you what the problem is, actually listen to them. I mean, it's really very, I thought it was really statesmanlike that you said there was going to be a public hearing tonight. I thought, oh, good, we're going to get some of the other information out here. But then we come in and we find out, well, no, it's a list, and, you know, we'll break the rules and we'll let you speak. But anyway, I'm going to wind down now because I know I'm just probably being, you know, I should shut up. So thank you, everybody.
Are there any questions or comments from members of the committee? Thank you. We'll take one more testifier. Biss, you're in the front row here. And then we will go back to the Becker City Council. And then after that, Becky Sugar, two city council members, the Clear Lake City Council member. And then we have, the next ones will be Tom Butts from the electrical engineer at the plant, Jason Pierce and Allison Krieger. And then we'll hear from the IBEW and the Boilermakers. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. And if you could, please tell us where you're from and write down there's a clipboard back there. Thank you.
I think it's working. Huh? Okay. Thank you very much. I am Barbara Commers. I'm from Clear Lake Township. I can see the power plant stacks from my front yard. We have two children who went to the Becker Public Schools, and I spent much of their years in school serving on committees at the elementary and high school. One of my concerns early on was when my daughter came home in fifth grade and a speaker had come to her class and told her that the emissions coming, the steam, as we've heard tonight, the fossil steam, was simply steam, clean steam. And we know now that those are toxic gases. I would just like to say at the beginning of this meeting, we pledged allegiance to our nation under God. And I hope that we will all take time to read the papal encyclical from one of our foremost leaders, Pope Francis. Pope Francis has told us that we are on the verge of climate catastrophe. He has told us in his encyclical all of the scientific evidence. I'm not going to go into that here. We can read that in his encyclical. He has told us that we need to develop immediate policies among countries in reducing our carbon emissions and our toxic gases. We need to make certain that our climate temperature is below 3.6 degrees from pre-industrial ages. We have a responsibility to the poor in the world. We are an affluent nation. And what we are using to maintain our lifestyles is severely affecting the poor in this world because of the emissions worldwide. We sit here in a beautiful, beautiful weather this summer in Minnesota. What's happening out west to the wildfires? My son lives in California. He talks of the devastation of that state, which will never change back to the way it was 10 years ago. Islands are being devastated. We're talking about the Arctic is melting. Sea level rise is expected to be over 10 feet. Billions of lives and incalculable suffering is at stake. And we cannot proceed as business as usual. We need to take action now. There is very, very little time left for our children and our grandchildren. We continue in our affluent lifestyles, and we need to look at what we are doing that is going to affect the generations to come and all the people who we cannot see, who are living and suffering in devastation right now because of climate change. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions or comments from members of the committee? Thank you very much. Mr. Henderson, Mr. Oliver, and Mr. Powers, you're next on the list. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and please do be sure to sign in at the testifiers table.
Good evening, members. My name is Rick Hendrickson. I'm Becker City Council. And just like to, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, welcome tonight. I'd like to thank you for coming out and hearing testimony from both sides here tonight. As an Xcel customer myself, I expect that Xcel Energy would be heavily reinvesting in R&D projects aimed at manufacturing electricity in a cleaner, more efficient manner. I'm reassured to know that in just the past several years alone, Xcel has invested millions of dollars in cutting-edge technology aimed at reducing Sherco's mercury and sulfur dioxide levels. Sherco meets or exceeds the EPA's requirements for coal-fired power plants because of these investments. I also expect that Xcel would be looking to the future by investing in technologies such as wind and solar. I come from the computer world, and anyone will tell you that the key to uptime is redundancy, not putting all your eggs in one basket. This is just as true with energy policy as it is with computer networks. Between the Fed's inability to resolve Yucca Mountain situation, or more recently, the Fukushima disaster, the nuclear option has at best been put on hold. We've seen the emergence of natural gas plants over the last few years. Although the emissions from a CCNG plant are cleaner than coal, ratepayers have also been exposed to the volatility of natural gas pricing, the type of volatility that is simply not there in the coal market. Coal consumers, such as Xcel Energy, often sign contracts guaranteeing the price of coal. In the case of Sherco, 3 trains a day, every day, for multiple years at the same price. This consistency helps to ensure that producing energy with coal is cheaper than producing energy from any other source. We cannot step off the boat until we have dry land under our feet. Intermittent energy sources, such as wind and solar, are simply sources of energy that are not continuously available. The biggest issues confronting intermittent energy sources have been, and continue to be, transmission and storage. Although moving carriages have been invented some 20 years earlier, it took a man like Henry Ford to come along with his ideas of mass production before cars became available to the common man. Ford's vision gave us dry ground to step onto, in that case, from horses to cars. This same thinking needs to be applied to our energy policy. We simply cannot abandon a baseload source such as coal until we have resolved the major issues with wind and solar, and they are no longer considered intermittent energy sources. This is where you come in. We all became involved in politics for the same reason, to make a difference. There are 2 things I would ask members that you would remember from tonight. Number one, everyone, from single moms to seniors on fixed incomes to small business owners to just plain old working stiffs like myself, everyone benefits from low-cost energy. Number two, prematurely removing coal as an energy source will certainly have a negative effect on the lives of most, if not all, Minnesotans. Mr. Chair, members of the committees, members of the committee, excuse me. I thank you for your opportunity to address you this evening.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good evening. My name is Adam Oliver, council member here in the city of Becker. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to address you tonight. It was wonderful to know that I wouldn't have to drive down to St. Paul, that instead you folks would be coming to us tonight. I appreciate that. I've been following this debate since I was 15 years old, 1995. It was the topic of debate that year in high school. Spent 4 years debating. This was actually probably the most important topic that we talked about for young developing minds. While I could talk further about the national policy implications, I'm here tonight to talk about the impact of this plant and the possible closing of it to the city of Becker. In Becker, we do support a diverse fuel source mix for producing power, including nuclear, coal, natural gas, wind, solar, all of the above, as has been mentioned tonight. We believe that using multiple fuels to generate power will will continue providing low-cost energy for the businesses and residential customers here in Minnesota. Now, as you've heard tonight, the Sherco plant employs 350 people and another approximately, say, 800 during times when they're doing turnarounds. More than half of Sherco's employees live in Becker and the surrounding communities. In addition to the local economy, power generation in Becker also supports regional jobs in the transportation, steel, machining, pipe fitting, mining, and railroad industries. Sherco, as Member Hendrickson said, receives an average of 3 rail deliveries of coal per day from the mines in Wyoming and Montana. In fact, for every one worker at the Sherco power plant, there are 5 service employees in the region that support the facility, creating an economic ripple effect throughout the region. Let's not forget that these people not only contribute to local economic activity, but they also support our local communities by sitting on the boards and commissions, serving on volunteer fire departments, delivering meals on wheels to seniors, building homes for the underprivileged, and many other opportunities that they engage in. Also, I think the committee should consider the economic development efforts Xcel Energy puts forth in the communities they serve. For example, they are involved in a variety of activities, including state and regional planning initiatives, long-term community planning, site location, direct business assistance, and energy efficiency rebates, just to name a few. Here in Becker, we work hand-in-hand with the folks at Sherco. They help us with lead generation. They also help us when it comes to bringing different businesses here to Becker. We want to know what the plan is to fill the void created if the coal power plant is closed. We want to know what the alternative fuel is to backfill the loss of power generated by coal. We want to know, when you talk about retraining these workers, what infrastructure will you be putting in place for them to work at here in Becker? It does the city no good if this infrastructure that they will be working at in the future is located outside of Becker. I'd like to close with this as the committee debates the issues. We'd also like you to consider the impact this plant has on school referendums. They're financed by property taxes. Now, because schools are based on enrollment, a decline in enrollment would also reduce funding to the local schools. When you take those 350 jobs out of Becker, chances are that's 350 families which will no longer have a reason to live here. Given the geographic area that our school system supports, I don't think we can afford to lose that many students here in the Becker School District. Thank you for the opportunity to address you tonight, and thank you again for coming out here.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much, Chair Garofalo. My name is Dale Powers, a member of the Clear Lake City Council. Clear Lake is 7 miles northwest of here. And with council members Oliver and Hendrickson from Becker, I do share their concerns about the potential closing of this plant. Sherco has provided our residents with an opportunity to live a solid, middle-class life in a rural area. The hardworking Sherco employees are not clogging up Highway 10 and I-94 to work in the cities. They're already conserving energy with short commutes to go with stable employment. Sherco provided those without a college degree an opportunity to earn a passport to what they consider the good life, a decent home at an affordable price, a stable school system that is the envy of the state, and a chance to raise a family and be part of a community that is welcoming. Now, I'm not testifying here merely as an elected official. I have lived in Clear Lake since 1978, but I also have a graduate degree in public administration and have worked in local governments in one form or another for the last 21 years. I understand all too well the macro argument that the burning of certain fossil fuels is deleterious to the environment, and as a society, we must change our ways to avoid what some are calling an environmental apocalypse. What troubles me about all of this is that the sacrifice is not evenly distributed throughout our society. This manifests itself in a number of ways. A trendy alternative to fossil fuels is wind power, and one only needs to go out to the Buffalo Ridge in southwest Minnesota to see the potential that tapping wind for power can bring. However, when this same resource is proposed to be utilized off the coast of Martha's Vineyard, the wealthy environmentalists file lawsuits designed to prevent them from the visual blight that they're asking others to accept. In the Twin Cities area, a system of rail lines is being constructed in order to reduce the number of cars on metropolitan highways. The only rail line that has generated a high degree of opposition is the Southwest Corridor from Minneapolis to Eden Prairie. Not a surprise, since the Blue Line and the Green Line run through middle-class and lower-middle-class neighborhoods where residents, quite frankly, can't afford lawyers. No such limitation is present for the limousine liberals of Kenwood, who, without a doubt, were preaching to residents near the Blue and Green Lines that the light rail was, quote, in their best interest. Given the $2 billion cost of the Southwest Corridor, no doubt it'll end up being called the Platinum Line. The second area that exhibits unbalance of sacrifice is in total ignorance of the micro argument. There are quite a few residents of Clear Lake and the surrounding area that work at Sherco. One regularly attends our council meetings and lets us know when some fancy alternative power proposal, solar is the trend this year, by the way, is, well, to repurpose a Texas phrase, all hat and no cattle. Another Sherco worker, a volunteer fireman, lives just outside our city limits and has been part of our community since even before I arrived 37 years ago. While being for alternative sources of energy might make for interesting cocktail conversation along Kenwood Parkway or Summit Avenue, along Church Street or County Road 23, there's another conversation going on, and it's definitely not trendy. This kitchen table conversation is between a husband and wife. And they're not talking about the benefits of not using coal as an energy source, although they might believe that to be the case. No Chairman Garofalo and committee, what they're talking about is how they're going to pay the bills when one of them's out of a job because of that dirty, nasty coal. You see, those people advocating for clean energy don't have to make any sacrifice whatsoever. It's real easy to protest something when you have no personal stake in the outcome. Real easy. For them, it's not all that different than complaining about the weather. The same can't be made for our kitchen table couple who have been told that, for the betterment of society, Sherco must close and you, kind sir or lady, are relieved of your duties after 30 years. Oh yeah, I'm sure that there'll be some way to get extended unemployment benefits. Perhaps they'll finance training the employee in a new skill or even put them in the dislocated worker program. It sounds so nice, so compassionate, and so understanding. Not. Why am I saying that? Well, it's real simple. The vast majority of people working at Sherco are in their 50s and 60s. Yes, you can retrain them till the cows come home, and you'll feel better about it yourself. The sad truth, however, is that no one hires people in their 50s or 60s anymore, trained or not trained. Employers want the shiny new model. They don't want someone that might retire in 5 or 15 years. That's the reality. I live it. So while you're looking at the issue on a macro level without regard to how it affects individuals, those of us on the front lines of local government are faced daily with the micro negative externalities. We see subdivisions that are half completed. Why on earth would someone come in and finish it off if the market is going to be glutted with homes from Sherco workers who need to sell their homes in order to meet daily operating expenses? And that's only the beginning. What I'd like to see, if coal is eliminated, costing hardworking residents their jobs, is for someone living in Kenwood or on Summit Avenue, whose most difficult financial decision, perhaps, is which stock to move their money into, I'd like each of them to select one middle-class family from this area whose life will be totally disrupted and upended due to their stubbornness and unwillingness to compromise and share in the sacrifice, and tell them face-to-face personally that their macro sacrifice is required for the macro problem to be resolved. You see, what the Liberals fail to understand is it's not macro to these potentially displaced workers. It definitely is macro. And I was fortunate enough for the last 2 weeks to teach 12th grade government at Como Park High School in St. Paul, not exactly an enclave of conservative political thought. We were talking about the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, and I told them I was going to be testifying here tonight. And I asked them the question, and they know the whole history of climate change and all that, and I asked them, should all coal-fired plants be closed? When put that way, the vote was 39 to close them and 26 to keep them open, 60% to close. However, when they were told their parents would be thrown out of work if that happened, the vote was 45 to 20 to keep them open. Out of the mouths of babes comes the truth. Thank you, Chairman Garofalo and committee.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments from the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next we have Mr. Butts, Mr. Pierce, and Ms. Krieger. And then on deck is Bob Bugren and Rich Zeman and Carrie Kowalski. Mr. Pierce? Okay. Mr. Butts, is he here? Oh, okay. Boots, where's Mr. Pierce? All right, so we'll go with just you two. Welcome to the committee. Please state your names for the record.
My name is Allison Krieger from Big Lake, Minnesota. You want me to continue? All right. My name is Allison Krieger. My family has served this community in many capacities, including being an employer and politically active for over 20 years. We deeply care about and are proud of this community. Having Metro bureaucrats consider or view this plant and people it employs as a threat to the well-being of the state is ludicrous. Owning an environmental company and working alongside the EPA, we move coal ash into cement kilns in order to create a less expensive cement and keep it out of landfills. Unfortunately, we learned while doing so that not all environmental theories or science are created equal. The environmental theories that appear to be the underpinnings of this current environmental ideology have been debunked by entities such as Heartland Institute from Chicago. So much so that world leaders refuse to sign binding treaties that can harm their individuals' nations' energy supply to the point of national security concern, as well as endangering their national wildlife, ironically the very things this current environmental ideology swears it will protect. Since humanity needs energy, my question to you is, what new contractor will make a profit from closing this plant? What current politician will benefit from closing this plant? What other landowner will profit from the closing of this plant? What other school districts will profit from the closing of this plant? What other municipality and county will profit from closing this plant? This proposal seems to be taking money and security from this school district, from these landowners, from employees, employers, and give it to someone else's due to recommendation of Metro bureaucrats. This area could possibly be pushed into higher taxes, higher unemployment, higher need for welfare, less money for education, depreciate property values, and an increase in government subsidies so that a Metro goal can be checked off. These people, this community, employers, our energy supply for this nation and national security is far more valuable than the checkmark that suits the ideology that some Metro bureaucrats are currently holding to. Many in this community stand with a resounding no to a recommendation and ideology that will temporarily benefit a few, with the potential to greatly harm this community and Minnesota as a whole. Perhaps citizens can inquire and assist working coal plants by creating a manageable way for them to utilize natural gas alongside coal energy, since both energy resources are viable for another 300 years and more are becoming cleaner as they are going into the air. By assisting, I am not purporting more rules and regulations, such as the upcoming energy moratorium that will extensively increase energy rates and higher bills for all Minnesota energy users, or by putting up more wind turbines or solar energy, which have failed miserably in other states such as California. Even the wind turbines in California are plugged into the power grid when they cannot produce enough energy due to wind currents, animals crushed in the blades, or engine failures, all, of course, which cost taxpayers much money to fix. Minnesota people are educated and intelligent, and will no doubt consider inputs and changes that have been proven for an extensive period of time. Minnesotans are also aware of and recognize ideas that have been faulty since the hypothesis were conceived. Most are not willing to be a guinea pig for someone else's profit. Again, this community and this community's security and well-being are far more important than a metro bureaucrat's to-do list that is based on questionable science, theories, and deals made in the back room over drinks. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Tom Butes, and I am coming just as a citizen of Sherburne County. I've been in the electric utility industry for 29 years, and I've been involved with many different types of planning studies, and I've come to appreciate that when it comes to assessing the viability of different options for the electric system, it is a very complicated matter, and there's a number of models that are used to try to assess that. And what I'm getting more and more concerned about is, in a matter of science, we have more what appears to be a middle school cheer fest going back and forth as to who's right and who's wrong. And we really need to get our technical feet on the ground here and say, what is a viable substitute for central station electric generation in our country? And so I have a couple points to make in terms of what I think is something to consider, and that is that when you have an electric power generation such as Sherco, if you noticed in the tour today, there was a display that said what the frequency of the system is, and it probably said like 60.002 or something. What's the big deal, the 002 business? That is the pulse and the heart rate that tells system operators how well the generation is balanced with the load, because electricity is produced and delivered and used in the same instant of time. That is a delivery challenge that is something that needs to be appreciated. If you look at that in terms of speed, that's like flying from New York to LA 137 times in a second. That's what we're talking about in terms of the delivery of the power. So we can't mess around and just say, maybe this will work and maybe that won't. And I want to highlight something that's very important to the electric stability of the system. And that is, when that generator is online, it is rotating, and there's mass associated with the generator, the turbine, the shaft. And if you go back to the math, it's represented by the variable I, which is rotational inertia. And what happens on the system is, when there's a disturbance and something, a line trips out or a generation trips out or there's a sudden change, the very fact that you have physical turning of that shaft keeps the system running, and it runs through those disturbances. Now, if you have a system with a DC source, solar as an example, and an inverter that's going to connect to the grid, the first thing a system like that will do when it faces a disturbance is it will disconnect from the system. That is not going to result in a reliable system. And those are the types of things that need to be looked at when it comes to saying, will the system be equivalent? Will it be reliable? Those are the types of models and studies that really have to be done to say, can you throw out 300,000 megawatts of coal in our system and say, we're done with that, and now let's just try something else. And I'm saying the studies are not adequate to really reflect that. And so the analogy that I'll give you is that when you're driving down the road and you're saying, who's hauling the stuff in our country from point A to point B? It's the semi-trailers that are doing that, right? If you wanted to say, how about if I back up with my 2002 Jetta and pop open the trunk, and if there's 4,000 of us, we could probably do the same as a semi. What I'm saying, it's not the same. And when you look at saying you could change out the whole system and throw out all your central station generation, you really have to look at the kind of studies that would support that or not. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions or comments from members of the committee? Thank you. And just quickly, what happens if that frequency goes too low?
Well, basically, generators will disconnect from the system because their turbines will be harmed if the frequency is too low. That's one of the things that will happen.
Yep. So the lights go out.
Yeah, and when it comes to system reliability, we don't know. The only reliability issues we know of are transmission or distribution. We've built our system so soundly to date as that we have reserve capacity that we don't even need to deal with reliability when it comes to generation, because we just make sure there's enough there, make sure there's enough there. And that's another thing that could really be in question when you change out the whole balance.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Bugren, Mr. Zeman, and Kerry Kolowski, IBEW and the Boilermakers. Welcome to the committee. Please state your names for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Bob Ugren. I'm the business manager of IBW Local 160. I represent about 350 members at the Sherco plant. And with me is Kurt Zimmerman. He worked at the Sherco plant for 27 years.
I'm Richard Zeman. I'm president and dispatcher for Boilermakers Local 647.
Kerry Kowalski, the apprenticeship coordinator for Boilermakers Local 647. We build the equipment that cleans up the coal that powers the U.S.
Welcome to the committee. Please continue with your testimony.
I'm here today to speak on the impact of the possibility of closing Sherburne County Generating Station, or Sherco as we know it. Our craft shares a long history with Sherco, starting in the mid-1970s when we assisted in building Units 1 and 2, and then Unit 3 in the 80s. Hundreds of our members moved into this area during this time frame to work at Sherco, and many of them still live here today, simply because of Sherco. After the construction phase, we continually worked with NSP and now Xcel Energy to provide highly skilled boilermakers to repair and maintain each unit. Each year, Sherco has a large schedule outage which employs 200 to 400 boilermakers from 6 to 10 weeks depending on the work scope. In addition to this, Sherco generally employs 15 to 30 boilermakers throughout the year for ongoing maintenance. The closure of Sherco would be a huge loss to the boilermakers. With around 600 field construction boilermakers, members covering three states, Sherco is by far the largest power generation site in our local. The loss would be unreplaceable. Maintenance at Sherco annually results in 150,000 to 225,000 boilermaker man hours, which equals up to 15 to 25% of our local's yearly total. Closing this facility would have repercussions not only on our craft, but the entire surrounding communities, and the boilermakers oppose any plan that would include closing Sherco. Thank you.
We, like I said, we have 350 members at the plant. These are good paying jobs. It's 350 families that are going to be out of work if they go through with the final plan. Those are jobs that are skill specific. You're not just going to walk out of the plant and go somewhere else and be hired. It's a big concern for us, and we just think that part has been overlooked a little bit. We'd like you guys to keep that in mind.
Uh,
I'm Kurt Zimmerman. I'm a business rep. This is my boss, Bob Bugrin. And I worked at the plant for 25 years, and then I came in the office as a rep 2 years ago. So I'm on a leave of absence from the plant, but I'm still technically there. And, yeah, it's a great – I worked in the coal yard. My whole – all but 3 months of that, I worked in the coal yard. It's a great place to work. We got, you know, great friendships, great jobs, great people. We do a lot for the community. I know there's business owners here tonight, people that eat and drink in their establishments after work. We, you know, it's a great place, and we're looking to keep the jobs. Thank you.
Didn't know I was making a statement tonight, but for the last 9 years, I've been training people to build pollution control equipment to help clean up these coal facilities and meet the EPA requirements, comply, and do all that stuff. And I guess if we take it to this next level, all I want to know from maybe everybody sitting up there is, what do I tell these people now?
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions or comments from members of the committee? Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming up and sharing your thoughts with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Shelley Mattson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and where you're from.
Shelley Mattson from Becker. I did not plan to talk tonight. I apologize for my attire. I worked all day and came here as a visitor. Just some things I wanted to talk about. I have had a small business in town for over 6 years. I employ 17 people, 15 of which reside in Becker, and two from other surrounding areas. We have been hammered as small businesses for years with other taxes and mandates and whatnot, and it is not an easy deal. I think everybody in this room, do we all want clean power? Yes, we do. Is it available right now from the research I have done? No. We need 24/7 baseload power. Nothing else provides it but coal. So we've got the people that want coal gone right now, people who want coal to stay. I hope we can find a middle ground and get there someday. Maybe we will. But I think all the things that impact this community with the closure of that, that built this school system, that built this town. People moved here because of it. I wouldn't have a business here if it wasn't for the power plant, because this town wouldn't be 4,500 people in its population. And so I just hope that when everybody is making decisions that they take a look at all of the parameters. And we all want a great environment. We want to leave a great environment for our children. But just boom, shutting down a power plant that can cause an impact on hundreds, if not thousands, of lives, I don't see the answer to that. So I'm hoping for a balanced approach.
Thank you. Any questions or comments for the testifier? Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Chair Garofalo, again for the opportunity to come here to Becker, to bring St. Paul here, to bring St. Paul home. This is a once-in-a-lifetime event, and again, I want to thank the members of the committee for coming here. We appreciate it deeply. It has been my privilege, I'm going to try not to get choked up here, it has been my privilege to represent this district. My heart is in this district. This is my home. As we all know, a few years back, the Sartell paper mill had a terrible accident. There were some fatalities, if I remember correctly, and the plant shut down. About 200 full-time feed-your-family jobs were immediately lost. Within hours after that happened, Governor Dayton, Senator Klobuchar, Senator Franken, anyone that was elected couldn't get up there fast enough to get their faces in front of a camera to say, we love you, we support you, we know this is terrible, we're going to do everything we can to help you. It is now those same exact people that want to pull the plug on my hometown, and I'm not going to stand for that. Folks in the legislature that know me know I get a little bit rabid when it comes to Sherco, and I'm not going to stop. This is our home, and this is what drives our economy. We've heard a lot about one community, Becker, in the surrounding area, and what will happen if this power plant is shut down. And we talk about the social cost of energy, Well, there's another community that is completely dependent on this community, one that we never hear about and one that needs a voice, and I'm going to take 1 minute to talk about them. It's the Crow Nation. There's an entire nation of people, the Crow tribe. I went and met with their legislature last year. They are the ones that sell us all of the coal that we burn at Sherco. They have a 45% unemployment rate, and the only good jobs on that entire reservation is at the coal plant or at the coal mine. I've had conversations with these people, and you know what happens if we shut down this power plant? We're not only bankrupting central Minnesota, we're pulling the plug. This, you want to talk about social cost? You look that nation in the eye. You look those people in the eye, and you tell them we're going to shut down your community. Now, these folks, they spoke with the federal representatives. I want to say the EPA. I'm not sure who it was. As all of this was beginning to unfold, a few years back, and they voiced their concerns. They said, "You can't do this to us." And the federal government's response to the Crow Nation was, "Why are you worried? You can always go on welfare. We're better than that. We are so much better than that." It's real easy for me to sit here and to rip on Governor Dayton. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to, from the bottom of my heart, from the very, very bottom of my heart, ask him, don't shut down this power plant. Join these other states that have saying, hey, this isn't right. Almost half of the states in the nation have said, this is not right. Please, Governor Dayton, I wish you were here today. I wish you had a representative here today, but you don't. So here is my plea to you. Don't do this, because this is your district too. Thank you.
Representative Baker still here? Representative Baker moves approval of the minutes from Friday, April 10th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. I want to thank members of the public as well as the members of the committee. Obviously, there will be multiple committee hearings going forward on this issue. And with that, we are adjourned.